these families, since antiquity, have believed that they were gods, and of course they have been worshipped in many periods as gods, and they continue to pass that prideful belief down from one generation to another. They believe that they're a superior being. Oftentimes, when I've seen quotes by these people or heard people relate what and they heard, they refer to us as ants or cattle. They basically have the idea that they were born to be gods and rule us, and we were born to serve them.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 5 o'clock. Welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on Friday the 14th of May 2021, streaming live from the People's Republic of Stokes Croft in Bristol and RadioQUK.com in Camberley, Surrey. The censorship and the self-censorship of life-saving information, sadly the norm today in the UK. The collusion of jellyfish media managers with Big Pharma. So if you too can restream us live or rebroadcast over the weekend, do please let me know and we'll credit you here. I'm the COVID secure Tony Gosling, having had the virus, I believe, back in when it was before it was supposed to exist in December 2019. And helping me review this week's news is on our post-election politics show is old Labour, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers. In part two tonight, 20 times more Palestinians dead than Israelis. So another assault is obviously necessary by the brave Israeli army on civilian targets in Gaza. And we look at the Nabka, the land grab by the supposedly Jewish state that Britain helped to create back in 1948. And WWF, no, not the World Wildlife Fund or the Worldwide Fund for Nature, another pro-Palestinian charity is closed down, websites closed and bank accounts seized so they can't pay lawyers to defend themselves. And we had Mark Sloboda on recently, a American teaching in Moscow. This week, Vladimir Goldstein, a Russian teaching in New York, on the fashion for fake anti-Semitism and much more. 62 million COVID vaccines contaminated at Emergent Biosolutions plant in Baltimore. What is the solution they want to emerge when 62 million COVID vaccines have been contaminated? We look at the incentives or otherwise on any vaccine company to produce safe vaccines when they don't have to pay through the courts when they get it all wrong. And the NHS app is going to become a vaccine passport apparently next week. The German, the Bilderberg 2021, no word. It could be next weekend or it could be the 29th and the 30th of May this year. Have they just gone underground? We have a look at the Council on Foreign Relations origins of Bilderberg with Jake Morfonius. I don't think that's his real name. I think he's a fan of The Matrix. He's called, I think, Blackstone Intelligence is his little outfit in the US. And also the 1972 Bilderberg meeting, which spawned David Rockefeller and Keir Starmer's wonderful trilateral commission, a Bilderberg for second raters. Will Banyan has been researching this in the run-up to Bilderberg time 2021. The invisible Bilderberg, who we're supposed to have forgotten about, and we probably weren't supposed to know about them in the first place. And also Conspiracy Classics number 6, John Morgan, now passed away, the Australian writer on the assassination of Princess Diana. But first, we look at the mayoral elections. We got Mayor Marvin, the Labour Mayor, is back. And the Labour Party have lost 13 seats here on Bristol City Council. The Greens have taken them, mostly almost all the Green, taken by the Green Party. And I imagine we'll have a next Green Mayor here next time. And a couple of favourites on this show when we were on FM, Afzal Shah and Tony Carey, both gone, sadly. The Metro Mayor is Dan Norris, as we found out last weekend. And we also look at Bright Green Lies, the hijacking of the environmental movement by high finance. Another documentary which has come out almost a year exactly after The Planet of the Humans by Jeff, can't remember his second name. But anyway, that was a terrific film last year. Very, very interesting look at the attempt by high finance to hijack the whole environmental movement, which obviously has big repercussions for the Green Party. I'll be looking at that in a minute. But on the political side, Martin, maybe we can start by just looking at the approach of Keir Starmer to his failures. I mean, I don't know if you will dare to admit that, that last week's elections were a failure for Keir Starmer, and particularly the Hartlepool by-election. But he's now appointed Rachel Reeves as Shadow Chancellor. Now, I thought Annalisa Dodds, I think it was before, was doing actually rather a good job. In fact, we had her on this show a couple of times, really sticking the knife in quite deftly to Rishi Sunak and Boris Johnson, over particularly over the awarding of contracts for COVID.
Yeah, well, obviously, Keir Starmer tried to get rid of Angela Rayner. That was the big story of the last week.
But she's elected by the Labour
Yeah, that's
members.
Right. Well, she's elected by the membership to be the deputy leader.
Why did he try to get rid of someone who's been elected to be his deputy?
Well, there's a lot of questions asked about that. I mean, Burnham, who's regarded as on the Starmerite wing of the party, immediately piped up and said this is unacceptable. So he's then had to find ways to placate her. I think he wanted to make her the scapegoat for what had gone wrong, because she was, in theory, in charge of campaigns.
Surely there should be no doubt about it in the Labour constitution. If someone is elected by the membership to a specific post, it's not down to Keir Starmer to decide their fate. It's down to the membership. I mean, you know, we have this, and you have this, I'm sure, in, you know, we have this in trade unions. Certain key officials are elected by the membership and others not, and it's not down to a union's general secretary, for example, to determine who's going to be the editor of our magazine in the Journalists' Union. That's selected by the members. And so Keir Starmer has really just got ideas above his station here, surely, trying to remove someone who's been put there by the Labour membership.
Well, she would have remained deputy leader of the Labour Party, whatever he did, but he removed her from her job, or one of the jobs she was doing, in terms of running campaigns. And as she pointed out, in actual fact, it was Keir Starmer's office that managed the campaign, and she was, in fact, didn't have very much influence over it at all. So that went down like a lead balloon on all sides, really. And then Starmer was forced to backtrack and speak to her, you know, her people speaking to his people, and they've kind of, you know, got back into some kind of alignment. But, I mean, that really was an unforced error by Starmer. I mean, if you're going to do something like that, you've got to be able to make it stick. And first, you know, the first question is, why would you want to do something like that? Because it looks very bad. You know, he said he was going to take responsibility for the results, and then he immediately turned around and tries to dump it all on her.
Well, no, that's fine, actually. Surely he's taking responsibility by changing the party around to make it better for next time.
That's what he would say. But, of course, if you're going to do that, you've got to be able to make it stick.
By taking responsibility,
he couldn't do that.
Surely he should just resign. I mean, that's really taking responsibility.
Well, there's all sorts of questions now being asked about
that. He wouldn't do that, would he?
Well, no, he's not going to do
that.
He's
like a limpet, this guy.
Well, the fact is, unless he chooses to resign, there isn't really a mechanism for forcing him out unless the Parliamentary Labour Party decides that they don't want him anymore. And we're nowhere near that stage.
So what about the elections here in Bristol? Because we've had your Marvin Rees, the mayor, re-elected. Are you happy to see that? I suppose you are, aren't you? You voted for him, I guess, didn't you?
I did, yeah. Well, I mean, I think the big story of the evening is the collapse of the Labour and Lib Dem votes to the Greens. They had a very good night.
Well, actually, to be fair, the Lib Dems only lost one, surely. It was really the Labour collapse to the Greens.
Yes, okay, but the Lib Dem vote collapsed to the Labour before that. I mean, Cottam used to be a Lib Dem stronghold. Then gradually it's mutated. And I think what's interesting...
Well, this is all because, really, of the coalition, isn't it? The Nick Clegg, David Cameron coalition.
That's right. I mean,
ended up being totally toxic for Lib Dems that have worked very hard all over the country.
Yeah, I mean, at one stage, the Lib Dems... I mean, we're talking now in the immediate aftermath of the Iraq war. The Lib Dems were, you know, taking Labour votes, no doubt about it. But once the coalition came in, they lost all of that. And what's interesting, I think, for the Greens... I mean, don't forget the election turnout is relatively low. It's not necessarily a general election turnout. But nevertheless, they seem to be taking votes from people who previously would have voted Lib Dem and people who previously would have voted Labour. So, you know, the Green brand is appealing to both those sets of voters. Now, they shouldn't get too far ahead of themselves because it's only a local election in Bristol, but that Bristol probably becomes one of their major bases now. They've got an MP in Brighton. Norwich was another place where they thought they might make a breakthrough, but I imagine Bristol has, put itself in their sights as a major place for them to operate.
Well, some Labour members, Martin, might say it's people like you that have forced the Labour Party down this road of railing against the Brexit vote, various other policies which haven't been very popular with the electorate, getting someone like Keir Starmer, who you voted for, taking over as party leader, someone who was simply put there by the establishment because he was a corrupt public prosecutor who they knew they could get to, throw the Jimmy Savile prosecution in the dustbin and, the waste paper basket and this sort of thing. And that this is, these sorts of policies have discredited the Labour Party. I mean, look at the way, for example, in Scotland, the Labour vote has collapsed. In the north of England, the Labour vote has collapsed. And there are people who've just sort of forgotten about the voters. They're in the Labour Party because their own ideological ideas, and the voters don't seem to matter. And that's why the Labour Party has just continued, particularly since Jeremy Corbyn departed, which some might say was rather unfair the way he was gotten rid of, even though he'd done reasonably well. And ever since he's gone, it's people like you who have sunk the party.
Well, there's an awful lot of non sequiturs in there, but where to begin? First of all, the people who voted Green, who previously voted Labour, didn't do that because the Labour Party was too pro-Brexit. The Green vote in Bristol are largely people who would definitely have voted Remain.
Because they're looking at Starmer and saying, this guy just looks like a blue Labour guy. We may as well be voting for a Tory or Blair or somebody like that.
I think there's an element of left-wing Labour voters. For example, the woman who resigned in Lawrence Weston, she stood as a Green candidate. She didn't quite win.
Oh, Jo Sargeant.
Yeah, she didn't quite win. She lost by 119 votes.
This is one of the things about these elections. People think that, people will vote for me because they know me and they love me. But actually, they're not. They're voting for the little symbol they're seeing on the voting form, which is a Labour, Tory or something else.
Yeah,
what
happened there, because it's a first-past-the-post election to the council, is that she soaked up quite a lot of Labour votes, not enough to win, but in actual fact, the seat was taken by a Tory. Yeah? So that's what happened there. So the combined Labour and Green vote in Lawrence Weston should have led, under a fair electoral system, to one or the other of them winning, but it actually led to the Tories.
But
didn't
that sour grapes from her, that she stood just to try to do that, to destroy the Labour vote?
I think what
she didn't know. She must have known what she was doing.
Yes, it's perfectly legitimate. What is going to happen in Bristol as we go forward is you're going to find discontented Labour activists defecting to the Greens. It's an inevitable process. That's because the Greens provide a credible alternative to the rightward drift of the party leadership in the Labour Party. But the Corbyn phenomenon prevented that from happening at one stage. People were so enthusiastic on the left of the party about Corbyn that they weren't going to dabble with Green.
So has the Labour Party blown it, do you think, for the last opportunity they've had for, what is it now? Hang on, because Harold Wilson was forced out by MI5. I nearly said resigned, but no. The fact of the matter is he was forced out by the security services in 1976, 86, 96, 106, 2016. So 45 years since there's been a credible Labour Prime Minister and leadership. And Jeremy Corbyn was the last chance. Now that's all gone. It's blown it.
Well, as I said to Corbyn when he was trying to be elected as Labour leader the first time, once Scotland goes its own way, as it has, then ultimately you're not going to win under a first-past-the-post system.
Potentially, a left-wing Labour leader like Corbyn could possibly have won back Scotland with a little bit of work.
It didn't work.
Especially since the Scots seem to be departing from the SNP because of Nicola Sturgeon. If you look at the way that Alex Salmond got a majority there, the last two elections, that they've had haven't had a majority because the people haven't been voting for Nicola Sturgeon with the enthusiasm that they voted for Alex Salmond.
Well, I don't think that stands up to much scrutiny. Alex Salmond stood and didn't get elected this time.
Well, it's not this time. We're talking about when he was leader of the SNP.
But that was then, and this is now. And
Nicola Sturgeon's been a disaster for the SNP.
No.
Surely, Jeremy Corbyn, if he carried on...
I don't think...
Just look at the figures. The SNP vote has gone right down, and they've now got a minority. They used to have a majority. So, that's just obvious.
Their vote at the minute is the highest it's ever been, Tony. So I don't see it's where
not,
you're going
no,
with that.
No, 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 it's not. The number of SNP representatives in Holyrood is far less now than it was under Axel.
I think we'll have to look at this.
You'll find you're wrong. That actually things are going back down for the SNP because of Sturgeon. And if you know, Corbyn had been successful and the Labour left had been carried on and been successful, then you'd have seen now, I believe anyway, you've seen Labour Party making inroads back into those Scottish votes. But it's not going to happen, is it now?
It didn't happen, and didn't happen under Corbyn, and it's not going to happen under Starmer. The SNP have consolidated their hegemony in Scottish politics, and they're now in coalition with the Greens.
So why has their vote gone down then?
Because people voted Green if they didn't like the SNP. And
How can you say they've consolidated their hegemony when they've gone from having a majority to a minority in the last two elections?
I'll just put it this to you, Tony. I'm actually a member of the Labour Party in England, and I'm not here to defend the SNP. But even so, the Labour Party hasn't got much chance of coming back in Scotland anytime soon with a leader like Starmer.
That's the point I'm making. Is he really a Union Jack waver, do you think?
Well, he said we've got to wrap ourselves in the flag. That's the quote that he made. Well. And, of course, that flag is not exactly super popular in the East End of Glasgow.
Did he really get that advice from... You know, I do wonder where he gets his advice from, because he just seems to make every
wrong
Rachel
foot. Reeves.
Seems to be working not only for the Tories, but for the Greens as well, Starmer.
Well, the point is that he is pursuing the policy that the Labour right have always pursued, and he's chasing these red wall votes who are pro-Brexit voters, and of course what happened in the by-election...
He didn't chase those votes. Martin, what are you
talking
about?
He tried to chase those votes, but they didn't vote for
him. No, he didn't. He didn't try and chase them. He put a Remainer in Hartlepool, didn't he?
Yeah, and in any case, even if he...
What are you talking about?
Well, we're going to have a very interesting test
in the Battley and Spain. It's a very strange way to chase Brexit votes by putting in a Remainer as your candidate. That's a very strange way to do it.
Now, I understand, Tony, that you pro-Brexit people don't want to talk about Brexit
anymore.
What we're doing is, you just brought that up, didn't you? Well, I know. If you want me to analyse what's going on, Tony, you've actually got to let me finish to make my point.
I'm saying that what you just said is nonsense. I'm trying to be polite about it, but how can you say...
I'll be polite and say, I think you're saying that's nonsense is nonsense, Tony.
How can you say he's chasing the Brexit vote when he's putting a Remainer in as his candidate?
I said last week that wasn't a very good tactical manoeuvre by him.
Well,
but
he's not chasing the Brexit vote, then, is he?
In any case, Tony, in the wider scheme of things, it's very clear that we were going to lose the Hartlepool by-election, despite all the crocodile tears from people like Mandelson.
You won't lose, or you won't win with attitude like that. You've got to win by putting a candidate in that people want to vote for.
No, you've got to win by having a general strategy about where you're going and why.
Anyway, you won in Bristol, so well done. And I think there's a lot of people in the Labour Party who will be looking at Marvin Rees and Bristol and saying, wow, they've really managed to do it there. We need to be copying their tactics,
In actual fact, Marvin's vote has gone down. What's happened is that he's managed to survive because of the transfer nature of the vote for the mayor. If that wasn't there, he might have lost.
Well, there's also quite a lot of money spent. Let's be frank about it.
Well,
advertising.
That's what political parties have to do. Sinn Féin used to rob banks so they could stand elections. Other people go to bankers
What do the Tory party do?
Well, the Tory party just do what the wealthy
do. They sit down with bank robbers. Yes, that's what they do.
That's right. So, in other words, when it's the political system is broken. Starmer has turned out his whole strategy of moving the party to the right in order to win back pro-Brexit voters in places like Hartlepool has failed. It was obviously going to fail in the first place, and it has failed. So he's now in a difficult position. What he needs to do, in my view, but he probably won't do it, is he needs to start talking about electoral reform with the Lib Dems, the Greens, and the Nationalists.
Well, that's because you failed to win under the first past the post.
Yes, because you can't win under first past the post if you haven't got enough votes.
Well, if you haven't got the right candidates, and if you've got a load
if you've got a load of
Blairites standing, you won't win anything.
No, indeed. But the problem is, if you've got a load of Corbynites standing, you don't necessarily win.
Well,
either.
It all depends whether Mr. Corbyn sticks to his principles or he caves in.
No, Corbyn has got to take into account that the majority of the young people who came into the Labour Party vote for him voted Remain. So, because they did.
Well, it's a great pity.
And now these same people are now voting for the Green Party. The Green voters in Bristol are pro-Remain, Tony.
Fine. Well, what I'm saying is...
So are most of the Labour voters.
That Starmer is not going to win by around the country, maybe Bristol, but he's not going to win around the country by putting in these Remainer candidates. Do you think he's going to change his mind on that now?
No. Well, what we've got with Rachel Reeves being put in place of Annalise Dodds, as you pointed out, Rachel Reeves is very much on the right wing of the party. She used to work in the Bank of England. I remember when the vote came up to say about cutting benefits for the poorest, she voted for it. She said at one stage that we're going to have to get rid of all benefits for under 25s in Britain. No benefits at all for anybody under the age of 25.
Yeah, she's very proudly said that she's going to be tougher on benefit claimants than the Tories.
That's right, and that's because they're trying to chase the marginal voters in the swing constituencies that might give them
this is what won the election in 97 for Tony Blair, isn't it?
It is, and that's why. And the point is that Blair didn't have a majority of the vote when he won the election. He just won the election. And one of the problems with Britain as we go into the biggest capitalist crisis of the 21st century is that the political system simply allows the Tory party, who are the minority, to have total power, because the system is rigged and designed to do that. And of course,
The Labour Party has got no tactics to deal with it. That's the problem. Is that they're standing the wrong candidates, and they've got no tactics to actually garner votes during the system. Sorry, for example, targeting the marginal seats with someone they actually think is going to get elected, rather than somebody that just happens to be on their side when the Brexit debate.
Even if they'd had a different candidate in Hartlepool, it wouldn't have made the slightest difference. The 10,000 people who voted for Nigel Farage at the last election voted Tory this time. And that's all that happened. Nothing, in fact, the share of the vote was virtually identical with the election
in
2019.
But it's all down. You know, we're on the downhill slide again now. Less and less people voting. Say in Hartcliffe, for example, only 20% of people actually went out and voted.
Well, that's pretty normal for local elections, Tony.
It's not at all. Only in very poor areas. So Westbury-on-Trym was 65%.
Well, one of the problems.
So it's not normal, is it?
No. This is the problem: is that the first past the post system means that the people in the poorest areas can't vote for candidates which represent their interests, because the Labour Party as a whole
has to keep. What are you talking about? They did, and they did elect them in Hartcliffe.
Yes, but it was only 20% turnout.
They can't elect. No, them. They did, and they could, and they did.
All right.
Anyway,
this is so difficult to have this conversation. If we're going to have a political analysis conversation, let's have a political analysis conversation where we can talk about cephology, what sections of the electorate vote in what ways.
Well, you can't
talk about electoral systems.
Martin, you can't say that the people in Hartcliffe can't vote for whoever they want because of the electoral system. They just did. And
no.
They brought Labour people in.
What could happen in a proportional system is that they could vote either for a right-wing Labour candidate or for somebody further left.
But you've got to cope with the system that you've got.
You can just say I'm not playing this by these games.
And
in Belarus, they said we didn't lose the election, we won it, and they went into the streets to try and fight it. In Scotland, they're going to say we're not playing these games anymore, we want an independence referendum, we're not playing first past the post under English rules anymore.
Okay, so
and they've got a majority for that.
You don't want democracy, no?
No, they want more democracy. They don't want, just as in Northern Ireland in 1969, they said we're not electing on the first past the post anymore. That's a system that we want to end in the southern
There's no prospect of that happening here.
No, there is, because
no,
the Scots
isn't.
Are going to force it.
Well, you think
the
so?
The Scots are going to force it, Tony.
Well, there may be another election in Scotland.
There will be.
You know, referendum in Scotland. The Tories may
resist that, but even so, that will...
And the Supreme Court may resist it.
Well, indeed, but at the same time...
And the Scottish people might not vote for it, either.
Well, they might not. And if the Tories are smart...
And then you're going to have another one, are you?
If the Tories are smart... They will go for an independence referendum now, because it's not clear that the SNP will win. But they're not that smart, and they're likely to oppose it, which means that more and more people will become in favour of it.
They'll have the election, and they will allow an election at a time they think they can win it, surely. I mean, they're not that stupid.
Yeah, and what seems to be shaping up now with the COVID inquiry being put off to 2022 is that they're going for a 2023 election. Once they've changed all the rules about how you vote, because of course we haven't covered this, that they've got to have photo ID, they're going to change the rules for mayoral elections so it's first past the post, so they're moving in the opposite direction.
They haven't said that now, have they?
They have. It's part of the Queen's speech.
Was it in the Queen's
speech? That's right, yes.
I never heard that at all.
Well, I thought
it was
in there.
There was a thing about the making voter ID,
yeah,
which is was argued on Question Time rather poorly, but it's obviously a way to stop people voting. You know, it doesn't seem to me there's any possibility of it being there anything for any other reason. It's to stop poor people, to give them another reason not to go to vote. You know, all piling all the other ones on, like there's loads of candidates that are, that they don't want to vote for anyway, and that aren't going to make any difference. And so, you know, this is just another reason not to bother to go down the polling station. But I mean, interesting what you were saying about Marvin Rees. You think he did quite badly, really, considering, I mean, remember, of course, you've got a Tory government in Westminster. You know, it on the rebound from that, surely he should be doing quite well, really.
Well, what's happened is his votes bled off to the left to the Greens. The Greens came second from nowhere. So, you know, there is an alternative left-wing vote in Bristol.
Do you think if he'd attacked to the left, he'd have done a lot better?
I think he could have done better, but I mean, the problem is that ultimately the Labour Party is the Labour Party, and he's basically aligned with Starmer, and the left-wing Labour voters who don't like Starmer, vote, a lot of them will have voted Green.
Well, he's also aligned with the city establishment, let's say, as well, yeah. Not just Keir Starmer. So the thing is, what he's now done with the Green vote that we've got, particularly with the number of Green councillors now equal to the Labour councillors on the City Council, doing very well, the Greens did extremely well, is that he's now really dangling this in, for the next election in 4 years, no, 3 years' time, I think it's going to be, isn't it? Isn't that, am I right? So that's in 2024, very interesting, that the Greens are almost certainly going to put everything into Bristol to get their first mayor around the country.
Well, we may already have a general election before then, as I say, because 2023 maybe, because the other thing that Boris Johnson is doing is he's withdrawing the Fixed Term Parliament Act so that he can go to the country at the time of his choosing. So what they're going to do is they're going to change the electoral
system.
Trying
to focus on Bristol itself for a minute, right? Okay. What Marvin's done by tacking to the right and by allowing all these like private developments and, you know, all the various other things that he's doing in the city, you know, persecuting the travellers with injunctions, this kind of thing. He's allowed this nice in for the Greens. And what I'm suggesting is that in 4 years' time, in the local elections, the mayor elections, the Greens are almost certainly going to win.
I think the Greens are looking very good in that context.
They'll be bringing members from all over the country to help with Bristol.
Yeah, and the other thing about it is because of the mayoral system, that I understand there's negotiations going on behind the scenes for the Greens to be part of Marvin's cabinet. So they would then become, you know, it would be essentially a Green Labour.
A common purpose cabinet.
Well, Green Labour coalition cabinet. Yeah. But if I was the Greens, I wouldn't do that. I would remain the opposition, because that means that whatever he has to do in the next few years, Marvin, that is, the Greens can just say we're not going to be, you know, they won't be dirtied up by getting involved in it, which then, of course, means that they're in the perfect position to criticise everything without having to take any responsibility.
So you're suggesting that he's inviting them into the cabinet is rather like a poison chalice there?
Well, it is, but the Greens seem, I mean, I think in a sense you can see why that might make sense for both sides. I mean, there's articles in The Guardian this week saying, well, if the Greens and Labour can show how they can work together in Bristol, that's actually what might happen in the country at large.
Well, I think they're both of these parties at the top nowadays are both in the hands of the same financial elite, the Greens and Labour. But anyway, let's have a listen now to the election results from last Sunday, I think it was. Wasn't it Sunday? Yeah.
By the time it came out, this is the council election.
Sorry, the mayor vote was Saturday, wasn't it? Yeah. It was all a bit confusing. We managed to get the Police and Crime Commissioner vote on the Friday evening. But let's have a listen now to the announcement of the mayor vote on Saturday.
Statement of local result as to the counting of second preference votes for the election of the mayor for the City of Bristol. As returning officer for the election of the mayor for the City of Bristol on Thursday the 6th of May, I hereby certify that the total number of ballot papers verified at the counting of second preference votes is 52,206. The total number of second preference votes given for each of the candidates remaining in the contest is as follows. Hoare Reuven Sandy, Green Party, 9,332. Rees Marvin Jonathan, Labour Party, 8,766. Candidates not remaining in the contest, 27,265. Total number of second preference votes, 45,363. The number of ballot papers rejected at the counting of second preference votes is as follows. Ballot papers on which more than one second preference vote is given, 15. Ballot papers which are unmarked as to the second preference vote, 6,818. Ballot papers which are void for uncertainty as to the second preference vote, 12. Total number of rejected ballot papers, 6,845. I declare that the combined total of votes given for each of the candidates remaining in the contest is as follows. Hor Ruvensandy, Green Party, 45,663. Rees Marvin Jonathan, Labour Party, 59,276. I hereby declare that Marvin Jonathan Rees is duly elected as the Mayor of Bristol.
Okay, so that's the announcement of Marvin, the mayor, winning. As actually, although, you know, I have my fingers crossed something might happen, but then you go, because we've been criticising him all year as being just a tool of the establishment, as we have. Actually, to a certain extent, we did, although less so, with the previous mayor, George Ferguson, who's an architect. Anyhow, so, Martin, quite a lot of... Well, particularly with the Police and Crime Commissioner election, very extraordinary thing went over in Wiltshire, which made the national news, which was the Tories' candidate for Police and Crime Commissioner in Wiltshire was barred on the 9th of May. That's after the election, when it was discovered that he had imprisonable driving offences. Now, that imprisonable driving offence was drink driving, and he tried and he succeeded in running for Police and Crime Commissioner for Wiltshire, hoping that he was going to keep this conviction for drink driving hidden.
Yeah, well, I mean, one of the rules of the silly contest that we're having for Police and Crime Commissioners is that
they've
got to have...
Why do you say silly?
There's no reason. The government set it up that you can't stand for Police
and
Crime Commissioners.
We definitely need more checks. All I'm saying, we definitely need checks, more checks and balances on the police. This is one opportunity.
No. As you know, I'm not very much in favour of Police and Crime Commissioners. They don't have them in Northern Ireland because whoever won the other side wouldn't like it, and that's it's basically a Yankee system. But if you're going, and of course the government,
Commissioner Gordon,
yeah, the government brought in the thing that if you couldn't have a criminal conviction and be a Police and Crime Commissioner, that's their decision. But I don't think there's any reason for that. Somebody could actually have more understanding of the criminal justice system if they'd had a conviction than otherwise. So, for example, in Northern Ireland, if you had Police and Crime Commissioners, which you don't, ex-prisoners could stand to be Police and Crime Commissioner. Why not?
Well, I suppose, one of the things particularly to do with police and crime commissioners I find particularly abhorrent is the idea that you might elect an ex-policeman to do it. Because the temptation there is quite obviously to be covering up for your former colleagues who, you know, maybe have been criminals or been up to no good of one sort or another. I mean, the fact that, you know, somebody, you know, at least someone who's independent-minded should be being put forward for these jobs, not a former policeman.
Well, I would argue that in actual fact, as the Police Federation argued on our previous show on FM, that the problem with having a Police and Crime Commissioner, either they've got no power, or it's political interference with the way in which the police operate. As you will see, there is no Police and Crime Commissioner in Northern Ireland. The head of the Police Service of Northern Ireland is now called, is not elected, and is only answerable to the Assembly, which includes both factions and non-faction people. And of course, previously, before we had Police and Crime Commission, we had a police authority, which was basically a committee with lots of different views
and
on it.
Guess what's happening? Who's investigating the Wiltshire and Swindon Police Crime Commissioner election and this Tory standing who was a convicted drink driver? The police are launching an investigation into it.
The fact is, if he's got the rules are, if he's got that. If you remember, we had a guy who was going to stand for the Labour Party, and he got a criminal conviction going back to when he was 15 for doing something with an air rifle. Do you remember? And of course, he couldn't stand. Now, I would argue that in actual fact, if you're going to have police and crime commissioners, there shouldn't be any problem with people having had criminal records, because they're likely to understand the system better than those who haven't. And of course, there really is a question, what is a police and crime commissioner for? If they're going to interfere with the way in which the police, then that's political interference.
I mean,
this guy,
Jonathan Seed, says he's bitterly disappointed. Well, actually, he's a crook, isn't he, and a con man.
Well,
how can he be disappointed? He's only disappointed that he got found out.
Well, what's what's extraordinary to me is that the Tory party didn't ascertain before they stood him as a candidate that he'd got a criminal conviction. How did that happen?
And now we're in the position where he's won, but he's also disbarred.
Well, they'll just have to rerun it again at public expense. And the Tories will no doubt win it. And
what, I mean, isn't it better to have the number two take the position rather than rerun it? I mean, because the Conservatives are clearly not going to win the second time, are they?
Well, not necessarily. People,
it's very unlikely that someone can vote for a Tory.
Don't forget that people, there's a very low turnout in these elections. Most people have got no idea what they do.
This
not
one,
least
this
the police
one will
themselves.
Be even lower because there won't be any other elections taking place at the same time.
Well, indeed. So, in other words, the whole thing, I mean, all of this police and crime commissioners, mayoral elections, all the rest of it was brought in by the coalition on the back of an envelope stuff that Cameron had picked up when he went to the US, because that's what they do. They elect job catchers and everything.
Anyway, the latest that,
you know,
is,
it's not the traditional way we do it in this country.
This will be fun, and it'll be interesting to see what happens. A fresh Wiltshire police and crime commissioner election is set for August. So, I'm not sure if they've got no police and crime commissioner. I bet all the criminals in the world will be coming to Wiltshire
well,
to commit
you'd
their
wonder
crime.
With no police and crime commissioner in place, what are they going to do?
Would anyone notice the difference?
That's right, the answer is nothing. It doesn't make any difference either way.
Anyway, that was a fascinating twist, I thought. What do you make of Dan Norris's election as the Metro Mayor around here? He did quite well, didn't he?
I think that is better news for the Starmer wing of the Labour Party, and of course Dan Norris himself said he thought that Starmer had helped him. So the Labour vote in Bristol stood up. The Greens just haven't got enough support outside the city. And, you know, in it, and don't forget, because again, you've got a transfer vote. If it was a first past the post vote, the Tories would have won it, which is why Priti Patel wants to bring us back to first past the post. They've realised that this transfer vote scenario does allow non-Tory candidates to win. So they're going to close that loophole before we're allowed to vote next time. It may well be that by the time we come to a mayoral election next time in Bristol, they'll have closed the loophole and made it sure.
Well, it's not a loophole. It's actually a much better system.
It is a better system, but from their point of view, it's a loophole, it's a bug.
I think
because it means that non-Tories can
win. To be honest
with
you, Martin, I know, you know, I think you bellyache about it too much, but I'm with you on this whole idea of getting rid of first past the post, because that really is the loophole, actually, is the first past the post system.
Yes.
It's very old-fashioned, it's crooked, it's corrupt, it doesn't allow new entry into the market, rather like we were talking about last week, about, you know, these big boys like Amazon and Schweppes or whatever, keeping the small people out of the market. That's what first past the post does.
Absolutely, and there's no other country in Europe that has it.
But it didn't keep Nigel Farage out of the market, did it?
Yeah, but Did he cheat then?
Or
no, but Nigel Farage, don't forget, he...
Was he just a bit cleverer than Starmer?
Can I just say, yeah. Nigel Farage built his career on being elected to the European Parliament, which is a proportional system.
Yeah, but then he capitalised on that. But I mean, in fact, many of these left-wing Labour people built their career in the Labour Party and in national politics. So they could surely, you know, start another party like Farage did here with UKIP.
No, well, what he did, if Farage had finally run his candidates in 2019 and every constituency had a Brexit candidate, the Labour Party would have won. But what he did, and he could do it because the Brexit Party is his personal creation, he just pulled all the candidates. And he basically gifted the Tories the election. But if he had stood under first past the post, the Labour Party would have won. And of course, that's the big advantage that they have on the right. It's not a democratic party, the Brexit Party, so it can just say, right, you lot, we're not standing. And they can't stand as Brexit Party candidates because he just decides we're not doing it.
Well, I mean, you know, the Labour Party, if it was to create a new lefty party, could have a similar sort of constitution, which will persuade or force candidates to stand down. For example, if there's a sympathetic Labour candidate there, they could stand down. We talked about this last week.
Yeah.
And really, it's, you know, I know you spend a lot of time railing against the system. I think you've got to play the system and then change it. Otherwise, you're just banging your head against a brick wall.
I disagree. We've got to start talking about constitutional reform as fundamental.
Well, they've been talking about it for the last 40 years,
no,
Martin.
We have. The Labour Party hasn't been talking about it. Mm.
Well, that's only because the Labour Party is now in an unelectable position.
Well, that's right.
So it has to be.
Well, indeed,
right. But then it's people like you that have created this position of the Labour Party being unelectable.
Well, what, by supporting Corbyn?
No. By actually undermining Corbyn. He wanted to be a Brexiteer.
No,
and it was the Remainer part of his party that persuaded him this was a bad idea. And he lost loads of constituencies. Yeah.
Of course you have never been a member of the Labour Party, have you? Ever? When were you a member of the Labour Party?
What has this got to do with anything?
I'm just pointing out, if you're a member of a political party, you can't just say, we're going to do it like this, we're doing it like that. In actual fact, you've got to get an agreement and a consensus. In the Labour Party, you'd have to go around and talk to various trade union leaders.
But the Labour Party has
been
sunk
constituents
by this, by the fact that Corbyn just refused to lead on the thing like anti-Semitism. He was saying, "Oh, well, let's have a little kumbaya. Everyone can get together and we can have everybody included, including the lovely Rachel Reeves." I mean, that just wasn't realistic, was it? Because Rachel Reeves was undermining him at every step.
Well, the alternative was to have a civil war in the Labour Party and really go for a civil war, which wouldn't necessarily
have
achieved anything.
You could have some expulsions,
either,
couldn't you, for example, of people that had criticised Corbyn. I mean, is exactly what Starmer's done, but the other way around.
Yes, and unfortunately, the system is rigged to help the establishment, whether in the Conservative Party or the Labour Party, which is why Sinn Féin went for an independent Ireland and the SNP are going for an independent Scotland, because they don't want to play that game anymore.
All the time the Labour leaders embrace Mr Mandelson, it is embracing the establishment. Anyway, look, let's move
Mandelson would have lost. If he'd stood in Hartlepool, which used to be his constituency, he would have lost.
Yeah, well, why is he still anything to do with the Labour Party? That's my question. I mean, the guy's quite clearly shown that his advice is bad
all
the time.
Because his father was in the Labour Party, and he was in the Labour Party, and there's a history and a tradition there, and you can't just kick people out.
I thought you didn't believe in inheritance.
I'm talking about political history.
Well, political inheritance. Anyway, look, Marvin Rees, let's have a listen to his acceptance speech as Mayor of Bristol. Well, this is the whole thing really will send you to sleep with the kind of gobbledygook management speak that I'm afraid we get from our mayor here in Bristol. But let's have a listen now, because the most interesting thing is, what is he going to do with his cabinet? Is he going to bring other parties in? And let's see what he's got to say about that.
You know, as part of that ongoing journey, what I will share today on the cabinet front is that, you know, I will be reappointing Craig Cheney as my deputy mayor and Asher Craig as my deputy mayor. And they will continue with their portfolios. And also to ensure consistency in the transition from my first term to my second, I'm also announcing the reappointment of Councillor Helen Holland, an adult social care, and Councillor Helen Godwin, to adult children and social care portfolios as well, statutory functions. I'm going to go forward with that cabinet at this time, and more announcements on the cabinet will be made in due course. In terms of our approach to the city, again, you know, it's an endorsement of the approach we've taken with the One City approach. We're going to continue working with our city partners. We have a meeting with a whole group of city leaders on Wednesday. We're going to continue with the One City plan and the priorities that have been identified for this year, but also the priorities that have been identified for the years ahead up to 2050. And I would encourage everyone to familiarise yourselves with the One City plan. I'm going to be visiting personally all the One City boards to connect both the boards that run the themes within the city office, but also boards like the Culture Board, the Economy Board, Nighttime Economy, again, just to reconnect after what is can feel like an absence of the campaign, and to make sure that, again, that we are working together, that people have been invested, and that that inclusive, diverse leadership that the One City approach has sought to foster is really understood and valued and really energised for the years ahead.
Well, that's okay then, because we've got the One City plan. The only trouble is the One City plan is all the policies in the city and all the discussions are decided by little groups of people on different subjects that are handpicked by the mayor, Martin. So there's no councillors involved in this, and this is all mates of the mayor making these decisions.
Well, that's what the mayoral system is, as we know. And of course,
what's the point in councillors then?
There isn't one.
it doesn't matter that the Greens, have done so well.
No, it doesn't. And of course, what Marvin is now able to say is, I got the most votes on a transfer vote. He didn't get the most votes in the first round. That is my mandate to carry on as I've been doing. So as far as I'm concerned, I've now got a 3-year mandate to do exactly what I wanted to do, and the voters have endorsed that. That's what he's going to say.
Well, he starts off there by talking about on the cabinet front, and I couldn't help but think of Jimmy in the Fall and Rise of Rhythm. All the Rise of Reginald Perrin. On the cabinet front, we've got and the these various boards he's set up, right? I mean, I was on the Cultural Development Partnership, which was is now called the Culture Board, and I witnessed, this is, I mean, I was on there for about 6 years. The whole thing was chaired by John Savage from Business West, also Labour Party member as he was at the time, until Jeremy Corbyn was elected leader and he resigned in disgust. And John was the chair of Business West. Now, this is basically the Chamber of Commerce for the West of England, chairing the Culture Board. In those days, we used to have people who were elected to it. I was from the voluntary sector. There were other people from the faith community. And John Savage came along in about, I think it would be about 2008, 2009, roughly then. And just completely reorganised it so that there were no people elected to it, that everybody was just handpicked. And so you had the heads of all of the places like the zoo, the museums, and they would all, and we used to all sit down and have very good conversations, which were quite wide ranging. But Savage changed the whole system to be what is now essentially this, this one city plan. I mean, it just sounds to me like, I mean, the expression the one city plan doesn't really mean a thing, Martin, does it? It could be a two-city plan. Is it a three-city plan? No, it's a one-city plan. But actually, what's happening is the divide between rich and poor is increasing just as quickly as ever.
Well, I mean, that's the wider socio-economic context doesn't change and gets and is getting tougher and tougher. But the actual mayoral system allows. I mean, basically, Marvin Rees does not have to appoint anybody to his cabinet. He's chosen to appoint various Labour people who are aligned with him, so he doesn't have to do that.
So he could have who in his cabinet? Could he have, say, an oil baron or something?
He could have anybody. I mean, and the same is true of mayoral systems in other parts of the country.
They've got to be councillors, haven't they? We haven't had any non-councillors in the cabinet. They can in Westminster, as I understand it, but not here in Bristol.
Well, I mean, but at the same
because
time,
they can get lords.
At the same time, he's got,
and you can make somebody a lord in up at the House of Lords and bring them into the cabinet.
Yeah.
But you can't do that here in Bristol.
Yeah, but
as
at the same time, what he's doing with these various, groups that he's created for around his one city plan project is he's allowed to appoint whoever he wants to those groups. And that is the whole point of having an elected mayor, is that there's only one source of authority. Everybody knows who the boss is. He decides. It's basically run like a company. And they can restructure things. They can decide what they want to do, close down a department, whatever.
If you run a country like a company, you start ending up with fascism.
Well, then I'm not in favour of a mayoral system, but that's what the mayoral system is designed to do. And of course, the people like Ferguson who are in favour of mayoral systems, the whole point is that the mayor becomes a bulldozer. They can just, if we've taken years and years and years arguing about a thing, having an arena, the mayor can just go, right, it's going to go there, bang, my decision, nobody can argue with me.
Well, I wonder if it is actually his decision or whether this is just what the speculators and developers want.
Well, I mean,
want.
It's up to, if people bend his ear in a certain direction and they're a success, then he can override even his own party. You see, the previous setup, the leader of the council couldn't override their own party. Their own party had some control over who was in charge and could even remove the person in charge. That is no longer the case. The mayoral system gives Marvin a direct mandate from the people of Bristol, and they have basically, what he will say is, I've got the majority, therefore people must be happy with the way I'm doing it, otherwise I wouldn't have won. That means I can carry on doing exactly as I wish. And that is the system. Now, what Ferguson chose to do when he was the mayor is he tried to have a more consensual approach and bring everybody in and try and get everybody on side. But Marvin is more of a, I'm putting my foot down, this is what I'm doing sort of a mayor. And there's no rules about it. The mayoral system as a system isn't really a system. It's an imported idea from the United States. And it's and of course, the whole thing of having a transfer vote, which they brought in, because it wouldn't make sense, to my mind, to have mayors with all that power and didn't have a majority. But that's what Priti Patel wants. She wants Tory mayors on maybe 30% of the vote to be able to have total power. And the same thing happens at national level, as we can see. If you look at the vote shares across the country, the Tory party actually went down in terms of their vote share, but if it was a general election, they'd still have a stonking majority and be able to do whatever they wanted, even though they're minority of the votes. And that's the fundamental problem. Everything that's happened in this country that's gone wrong since 1979 is based on the fact that the minority have been able to enforce their will over the majority, and it wouldn't happen in any other European country.
So how do we fix it? You just want to change the electoral system, do you?
Well, in Ireland and Scotland and Wales, they've got a third option, which is just opt out of the United Kingdom. And that, of course, is definitely going to happen, I think.
Well, definitely, I think, doesn't really mean anything, does it? Scotland and Wales. Wales, you know, I don't think that's realistic at all.
Well, but it Scotland, depends if certainly, not Scotland's
And
gone.
Certainly not Northern Ireland. I mean, you know, what are you talking about? Maybe Scotland, but not the others.
No, in Northern Ireland, the majority of people, by 60%, voted to remain in the European Union. And, of course, they can't actually... The only reason why the nationalist majority in Northern Ireland, which is becoming that, can't say we're going to have a united Ireland or we're going to stay in the European Union is because of the Good Friday Agreement. They've got to have some loyalist representation at the top. If there was an election held in Northern Ireland tomorrow, Sinn Féin would be the biggest party. Michelle O'Neill would become the Prime Minister. And, of course, on this week you may have noticed that after 50 years, the British government has accepted that the Ballymurphy massacre was indeed a massacre, where over 3 days the paratroops killed 10 people out of hand in West Belfast.
At which point the British government is trying to say, well, actually, we think that there should be no prosecutions whatsoever should be allowed from those days, and we just have to accept that if there were murders done by the state, that they're not going to be investigated or prosecuted.
That's right. And is that a democratic system, Tony?
Well, no.
No, well, that's right. So ultimately, the people in Ireland...
You're finally finding out what we get up to, in which case we're now going to shut the door and make sure you can't do anything about it.
Yeah, but of course, the answer in Ireland, in Scotland, and of course, if Ireland and Scotland go, it's what happened in Yugoslavia. Slovenia declared independence, then Croatia, then Bosnia, and ultimately Kosovo, Macedonia, etc. And breakups, like breakup of the Soviet Union, once it starts... It's difficult to stop.
Okay, well, that's it for our local politics view, although we may be, coming back to that, who knows. But I thought it'd be interesting to look, Martin, particularly because of the resurgence of the Greens, at this kind of, you know, we've had fake Labour, the fake anti-Semitism, the fake Blairs, the fake Starmers. And what about the fake Greens? Because the Greens are kind of coming along. They're waiting in the wings. They're certainly here in Bristol. They're now equal with the Labour Party on the City Council in terms of councillors. We've had them doing very well over the years in fairly harmless positions, one might say. And that's a bit mean, isn't it? Like, so, for example, as Mayor of Stroud in Gloucestershire. And we've had Caroline Lucas as the single Green MP in Brighton. But they're now starting to do better and better. The only problem is that the Green Party has been moving very much away from its environmental roots and towards a direction which has been given, it seems, essentially by the financial industries, who have realised that they can't have a war in the Middle East and still get loads and loads of oil. And they also want to get rid of fossil fuels for all sorts of other reasons. So the Greens have now done things like embracing, which I find almost impossible to believe, embracing nuclear power. What is it, Martin, about the Greens and the environment that they don't get about the nuclear power being damaging and dangerous? So not only is it propping up this obsession with manufacturing plutonium for nuclear weapons, but then they're creating this waste that can never ever be gotten rid of again, and doing something very basic, which is at least 10% increasing of childhood leukemia around these nuclear power stations. But the Greens seem to think this is environmental and fine.
Well, I think I'm not quite sure that that is their policy, Tony. In Germany, the Greens are very definitely anti-nuclear.
No, I'm talking about the British Greens, well, and I'm talking about the
George
The Green Party's official policy is pro-nuclear.
Is it?
Yes, it is.
I'm surprised to learn that.
Well, and also...
I don't think it is,
and also, the Extinction Rebellion is very pro-nuclear.
Well, I don't know whether that's Extinction Rebellion. You can't say what their policy is.
What they're saying is, there's groups in part of Extinction Rebellion who are putting out all sorts of information at the moment about being pro. Maybe you haven't seen it, but they're saying things like, you know, you've got to get off the fence and be pro-nuclear. What are you talking about?
Okay.
You know, we can't survive just on wind turbines alone, and we need the nuclear industry.
All right. Well, there's certainly, George Monbiot, for example, is pro-nuclear. There are Greens who are pro-nuclear, but I'm pretty certain that Friends of the Earth and Greenpeace are not, and I'd be very surprised if it was Green Party policy.
Well, the Green, I mean, this is, okay, so...
You're asserting that it is.
I am, that's
a question of fact.
And,
it either is or it isn't.
And the reference that I'm using for it are this article on Paul Mobb's website, which is called Bright Green Lies, a review of Julia Barnes' documentary and its deep green message. And this is a new documentary which has come out roughly a year after Planet of the Humans by Jeff Gibbs, whose surname I forgot earlier. But Bright Green Lies takes another look at the green industry and what it says is being basically hijacked.
We're in the midst of six major extinction of life on this planet.
Paper or plastic is really not the question at this point. It's life versus a bare rock.
High voltage, keep out, authorized personnel. What's going on back here?
This movement that was so honorable and so impassioned has turned into something completely different. It's all become, how do we continue to fuel this destruction?
There is a push for a 100% renewable world. What they don't talk about are the unseen harms caused by these technologies.
You may not directly be seeing any smoke come out of any smokestacks, but that doesn't mean it's not happening.
Companies are involved in these activities to make money. They're not trying to displace or change other things.
What they're actually talking about is sustaining high-energy ways of life at the expense of the natural world.
I'm not comfortable with an industry that deceives me about something as important as climate change. They claim it is good for the environment when actually it is harmful for the environment.
The shit ain't green.
Well, that was an extract from this film, Bright Green Lies. I think you may be right, actually, Martin. The Green Party is still... but there is a big campaign within the Green Party, which is pro-nuclear, and a less, it seems, less high-profile campaign, which is anti-nuclear. But this is an increasing trend within, particularly within groups like Extinction Rebellion. There's Paul's pointed out this... Paul Mobbs, that is, this section of Extinction Rebellion called Emergency Reactor. They say things like green groups either back nuclear or back down. They say either you're against climate change or you're against nuclear power. You can't have it both ways. Stop hanging on to hippie era conspiracy theories and join us in the fight of our lives to end the climate emergency. It's not too late to be on the right side of history, they say. React now. World governments, stop dithering and build more, not less. Aim for 50% nuclear, at least, as per the science. Extreme overregulation and lack of financial commitment have let costs of nuclear soar. It doesn't have to be this way. Many countries are building reactors quickly and at very low cost. What are you waiting for?
Extinction Rebellion is not a... I mean, it's not a political party, and therefore anybody can speak in its name, and there may be factions within Extinction Rebellion who are pro-nuclear. Clearly these people are. Lots of others wouldn't be of that opinion. And the green movement in general has been anti-nuclear. There's been a certain minority view, people like Paul, George Monbiot spring to mind, who have been pro-nuclear.
That's right, he jumped on that one straight after Fukushima, which was rather handy for the nuclear industry, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I mean...
As Germany's shutting down its reactors, you've got the Guardian columnist saying this is the last thing we're going to do in Britain, and of course we're now building Hinkley C at massive expense down the road here.
All right, but the point is that people's views are going to vary. Some people are going to be green and anti-nuclear, and they would argue that that's consistent.
Well, I'm saying
this
is the drift.
A minority would argue the opposite.
This is the drift of the Green Party, anyway. And this,
well, it's not necessarily. I think in Germany, the Green Party is pretty solidly anti-nuclear.
No, I'm talking about the British Green Party, right?
Well, the British, but the German Green Party are going to be the biggest party at the next general election.
Definitely pro-nuclear. The drift. Anyway, even if it isn't as an official policy at the moment, the last thing I could see which was anti-nuclear in the Green Party, looking up a minute ago, which was a very unequivocal anti-nuclear, was in 2011. But anyway, this film, Bright Green Lies, it's also a book as well. There are various people putting cases in that film. I see what the names are. Derek Jensen, Lier Keith and Max Wilbur. Anyway, let's have a look at some of the views that they're putting across. People rarely question the solutions they're taught to embrace, but with all the world at stake, we must start asking the right questions. There's a push for a 100% renewable world, and after the research I've done for this documentary, I want no part of it, he says. Julia Barnes, she's the documentary maker. I did not become an environmentalist to protect my way of life. or the civilization which I live. I did it because I'm in love with life on this planet, because the world I love is under assault. The film is for those whose allegiance is with the living world, those who would do whatever it takes to defend it. Another one of these, Jensen now also says, I just wish they had both of their names, but this is the surnames they just put here. You will have hundreds of thousands of people marching in the streets of Washington or New York or Paris. If you ask those individuals, why are you marching? They'll say, well, we want to save the planet. And if you ask them for their demands, they'll say, we want subsidies for the wind and solar industry. That's extraordinary. I can't think of any time in history when any mass movement has been so completely captured and turned into lobbyists for an industry.
Well, I mean, the green movement, as it grows, and I think it is going to grow as we go forward. I mean, as I said earlier, the Green Party is likely to be the biggest party at the next election in Germany. You're going to find splits developing. There's already traditionally been a fight within the Green Party in Germany between what they call the Realos and the Fundis.
But I mean, isn't this rather than just a split, surely this is a hijacking by a lobby?
Well, I think that what's very interesting with the World Economic Forum and the Great Reset is that the financial elite see climate change as a cover for imposing their financial solutions. And therefore, the Greens could be drawn into the orbit quite easily of the financial elite, because they see climate change as the main threat. Whereas in my mind, the main threat is A, nuclear war, and B, financial collapse, none of which can be dealt with by doing stuff, fiddling with relative carbon prices. I think like any mass movement, as it grows, you're going to get different views, some more radical, some less radical. And don't forget that also the co-optation of the existing establishment. I mean, 30 years ago, you wouldn't have found people at the World Economic Forum going on about the destruction of the planet. But they, of course, have realised that that's the mood music that they need to carry through their existing financial domination.
Another little snippet from this documentary. The natural world isn't really part of the conversation anymore. Kumi Naidu, who's the former head of Greenpeace, I was watching him being interviewed the other day. He's saying, the planet's going to survive. The oceans are going to survive. The forests are going to survive. It's really about, can we save ourselves or not? And I just saw that, and I'm thinking, what the hell are you saying? This is someone who's considered to be one of the top environmentalists in the world, and he's saying, we don't have to worry about the forests or the oceans. I mean, that just betrays a complete lack of empathy and connection with the natural world. I don't know how you can possibly say that when we're in the midst of the sixth great mass extinction and it's being caused by industrial culture, that it's being caused by the same institutions, the same economies, the same systems, the same raw materials, the same extractive mindset that's being used for these renewable energy technologies. So he's saying is they're just taking non-renewables and transferring it all to renewables, Martin.
Well, I mean, that sounds to me, obviously I haven't seen the film, like a deep...
Neither have I. A deep... Because, I'm going to have an effort to watch it over the next week. I just saw a trailer for it, but I've read several reviews of it, and this is part of
it. Well, it sounds to me like a deep green position, which was first articulated by the Norwegian philosopher Arne Naess. And basically, it's anti-human. You know, basically, the human beings are the problem. The natural world is more important than human beings. And that's what Murray Bookchin, called Eco Lala, because he basically said that the point where you...
But surely both are important, aren't they?
Well, I would argue... You know, I would argue as a socialist that both are important, yeah. But, of course, there is a split within the Green Movement between those who think that the environment is more important than people and those on the other end of the chain, Murray Bookchin, who wrote the book Post-Scarcity Anarchism, that, you know, human beings are still more important, you know, as important
this
as the planet.
This rewilding agenda is a very interesting one, isn't it, where the idea is that you've got to clear more people out of the countryside to make way for wild animals.
Yes, and this kind of tension is inevitable if you think about it. It's a question of emphasis and an orientation, isn't it? Murray Bookchin, interestingly enough, has been very influential on APO, who's Abdullah Öcalan, who's the leader of the PKK in Turkey, who's in prison in Turkey. And he read Murray Bookchin in prison, and that's what led him to reorient the PKK, were basically a Marxist-Leninist militant military organization, towards decentralized democracy and gay rights, etc., which is a big transformation there. But of course, further to the left, if you can call it that, you've got your deep greens, who basically see the environment and the survival of the environment as more important than people. And of course, I don't necessarily agree with that, but you can see where they're coming from.
Yeah, but it does kind of sniff of fascism, doesn't it? There's an article in 2017 in November by Steve Bush, headlined "The Nazi Roots of the Environmental Movement." Well, I mean, you know, I'm sure there were environmental. I don't think the Silent Spring lady. What was her name?
Who?
Silent Spring.
Rachel Carson.
Rachel Carson, that's right. That she was a Nazi, definitely not. You know, the original Soil Association people, were they originally Nazis? The organic movement, no. But as he points out, the radical environmentalism, aka the green movement, deep ecology, or he calls it rewilding, is a philosophy that elevates nature over man, as you were saying, Martin. Hitler incorporated this naturalistic philosophy in his infamous treatise, Mein Kampf, where he blamed the entire Jewish race for what he called the pacification of nature. According to Hitler, the Jews, and a lesser extent Judeo-Christian ethic, that stemmed from a belief in God, were responsible for wrecking the environmental health of the planet. Hitler believed that Jews and Christians accomplished this evil deed through the promotion of capitalism, international commerce, and communitarian values of communism. Now, when the Green Movement starts to creep into this area, surely, you know, there should be alarm bells ringing, and at the very least, it needs a proper look at.
Yeah, well, I think what you find, the more you look into political philosophies, the more internal contradictions there are.
And also, you know what? They're being recycled, is what I'm saying. They've been rebranded, almost like a new washing powder.
Yeah, well, what's the real danger for the mainstream green movement at the moment is, as they become more successful electorally and so on, they're going to be drawn into what are basically imperialist politics. So the Green Party in Germany, for example, is opposed to the Nord Stream 2 pipeline from Russia. They claim to be opposed to it on environmental grounds, but they're also opposed to it because, as we all know, Putin is a fascist, and the Ukrainians are being persecuted by the terrible Russians. And, of course, Joschka Fischer, who became the first Green foreign minister in Western Europe, as soon as he became the foreign minister in the early 90s, he was put on the spot, are we going to go to war with Serbia? And he then decided that he was going to go along with that. And this is what happens. Greens are obviously focused on green issues, but when you come into power at a national level, it isn't just about green issues. You've got to decide whether you're going to go to war, whether you're going to be part of NATO, whether you're going to bail the banks or not.
Yeah, but
let's
get back to what the Greens really started on. I mean, a lot of this has been about energy, hasn't it? About what energy is useful, and which is going to be good for the planet and which is going to be bad for the planet. And I was fascinated to see that the former hero, or anti-hero, some would probably say, of the miners' strikes in the 1970s and the 1980s. I mean, this is one of the fascinating aspects of this to me, Martin, is the way that everybody now says that coal is such a terrible thing. Well, they've just kind of gone along with Margaret Thatcher and the coal strikes of the people that were trying to close the pits down in the 70s and the 80s. You know, you would have thought surely the left, and at the very least the trade unions, would be saying, well, actually coal is it was the international bankers and the international oligarchy that closed down the coal industry and took on Arthur Scargill and whatever it was, 150,000 miners.
Yeah, well, I went to a very interesting debate in the Cube here. It's a little micro cinema, quite a few years ago now, and it had Des Dutfield, who was the chair of the Tower Cooperative Colliery. So this was one colliery that remained open in Wales, and it was bought out by the workers, and it was turned into a cooperative. It's closed now. But he'd been one of the leaders of the strike in Wales, and of course they then bought out their own colliery. And he came to speak, and it was just when the anti-climate change protesters were getting to be big, so the Cube was packed with young people who were anti-climate change, and therefore potentially opposed to coal production. And he made a very good point, which I thought was, he said, there are no enemies in this room. So he's trying to reach out to them. And he said, but if you're going to build wind generators, for example, you need steel. And to make steel, you need coal. So in other words, there's a middle road whereby if you're going to move from a fossil fuel economy to a non-fossil fuel economy, it's a process, not an event. And you've also got to take into account the social implications of closing down things like coal industries. You can't just throw everybody out the door in one go, which is what Thatcher did. And I remember when I used to teach economics in the late 80s, one of the things we had to look at was what collieries were and were not viable. And so this was a thing that A-level students had to look at, about which collieries were and were not viable. And some of them weren't making any money under any circumstances. They're, you know, basically marginal. Others were making quite a bit of money. Some were somewhere in the middle.
Because these sorts of collieries would only survive, the marginal ones would only survive under a nationalised system. If it was all privatised, they'd have gone to the wall ages ago.
That's right. Well, I mean, that's effectively what's happened.
But this is so the government decided that it's going to take a very central role in ensuring the nation's energy supply.
It was a nationalised industry.
But it wasn't just that one. It was you know, electricity, gas, etc. as well.
Yeah, but I mean, there are two things to take into account. One is, if you close a marginal pit, you've then got to put on the negative side of that all of the benefit payments and knock-on effects. So you might choose to keep something running at a loss rather than just chuck everybody out on their ear and then have to find some other work for them. But the other point is, of course, what Thatcher did was she deliberately closed the maximum number of pits in order to break the NUM, in order to break the labour movement, in order to financialise capitalism. So that's what was going on there.
There was no reason
to close so many pits in that way.
There was always also a paramilitary version of the police that started turning up.
Well, that's right. And, of course, she was prepared to spend any amount of money to break the NUM.
Including using the security services.
Indeed, as we know. Roger Windsor, who was Scargill's right-hand man, had been working for MI5 for years. And at a crucial moment of the strike, and we know from Seamus Mills' book that Thatcher was in tears in the cabinet because they realised that after nearly a year on strike, the miners were going to win. And then Roger Windsor appeared in Tripoli giving Colonel Gaddafi a cuddle and asking for support for the strike. And, of course, that helped to undermine the strike. And, of course, he was actually a British agent working for MI5 for years.
So Arthur Scargill was being spied on all the way through.
Well,
a bit like
Scargill,
the spy cops.
Scargill was a bit of a damn fool for allowing him into his entourage.
It's easy to say that afterwards. I'm not working for MI5. Let's have a listen now to Arthur Scargill, bringing him up, to talking on Guardian podcast from 2008 here, and looking at some of the sort of issues that Greta Thunberg was looking at, and this is like 15 years ago.
If people are not made to do things, then they won't do them. But there's no reason on earth why governments all over the world, and in particular in this country, cannot do what they said they would do, and that is meet the decision of the Kyoto Agreement to reduce the amount of CO2 into the atmosphere. In order to do that, it means it must be mandatory that all existing coal-fired power stations, oil-fired stations, and gas-fired stations, all which produce CO2, should have fitted carbon capture and should be having fitted all the technology that we know does exist, and in that way, we would not merely reduce it, we would practically eliminate it. I don't think either this government or the previous government had any determination to do anything about it. Don't forget, these are the people who crucify the coal mining industry, and one would have expected, having closed 192 pits, dismissed 170,000 miners, closed down something like 60% of coal-fired generation, or made it non-operational, there would have been a reduction in CO2 emissions. And in fact, there's been an increase.
Interestingly, it finishes off there, and the interviewer from The Guardian interrupts him, just as he was saying, actually, that as they were reducing all these things to do with coal-fired power stations, emissions were going up, Martin. So he's saying there that, you know, they completely got their science wrong. But it's some interesting figures in there, aren't there? 192 pits closed, 170,000 miners, and 60% of the coal-fired power stations were closed down. That was by the mid-noughties. Actually, nowadays, of course, there are, I don't believe there are any coal-fired power stations left, are there? Well, maybe one or two.
Yeah,
but almost none.
The person that actually ran the tower cooperative I mentioned earlier was not Des Dutfield. He used to be head of the NUM. It was Tyrone O'Sullivan. So I've just corrected myself there. I just reminded myself who he actually was. Yeah, well, I mean, the fact is that, you know, countries like China, for example, are still very dependent on coal because they've got a, you know, despite their modernization, they've still got a very backward industrial structure. And if you're going to upgrade, you've got, it's, you know, so economic change takes place, but there's no reason why people need to be thrown under the bus while you're doing it, which is the argument for planning. And I used to argue when I was at New Economics Foundation that if you want to reduce CO2 emissions, you've got to plan for it, just as Britain did during World War II. E.F. Schumacher, who wrote Small is Beautiful, used to be chief economist at the Coal Board, and that's where that was his background. And, of course, during the war, there was planning for how much coal do we need to produce, how much are we going to need. And it wasn't really a question of how much it was going to cost. It was how much did you need. And if you're going to reduce it, then you've got a plan to reduce it. But that means you've got a plan to redeploy people into other industries and stuff like that, which is exactly the sort of way that the Scandinavian countries have operated for years. If they decide that they're going to run an industry down, they don't just chuck everybody on the dole. They make a plan to do it. They retrain people and they redeploy them. That's the way forward.
It seems to me that the whole coal business and what we're dealing with today with the movement of the Greens towards nuclear is really, this is just the industry deciding for itself and the people that finance it what's going to go on. And they're using these environmental arguments, at least they're attempting to hijack environmental arguments to justify their case. Well, actually, it's really a strategic decision about energy and who controls it.
Well, I've mentioned earlier that the very, very politically important Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which brings gas to Germany. The German industrialists want this pipeline. The European Parliament have already said that they should, they've already voted that it should be stopped. The Americans have put sanctions on all the companies that are involved in building it. But it's got such a big support from German industrialists because it basically reduces their costs. It means that the people, the manufacturing industry in Germany will have lower costs because they can get cheap gas from the Russians. And of course the Americans want to sell their own more expensive gas, which will be brought over in ships, which is a much more, you know, ridiculous and expensive way to do it. But the Greens in Germany are definitely being the Americans are very pleased, the Biden administration is very pleased that the Greens are opposed to Nord Stream 2. So what may happen if they win the election in terms of being the biggest party, because of course in Germany they haven't got a first-past-the-post free-for-all, they'll be the biggest party, but they'll have to form a coalition with somebody else. It may well be that they will not be able to force through the closure of Nord Stream 2. Although I think the Russians are now basically thinking, well, if this doesn't happen, it doesn't happen. It's up to the Germans if they want it or not. They can either have cheap gas or they can have expensive gas.
Well, there's a whole load of a hoo-ha, isn't there, about this Whitehaven coal mine, which is supposed to be the first coal mine to reopen in Cumbria. Yeah, so what do you think about that one?
Well, I mean, what the NUM would have said about that years ago is that deep coal mining is much less environmentally destructive than open cast mining. So a lot of coal, there is coal still used in Britain, but a lot of it comes from Colombia. And it comes from the Alcalajas mine in Colombia, which is the biggest hole in the earth on the planet. It's nine miles across.
Back in the 1980s, when they got all the coal miners up against the wall and shot them, you know, what they were doing effectively was saying, well, we can get this stuff cheaply imported on great big ships from other parts of the world, much cheaper than you can, and the people that are mining that coal abroad are, you know, on slave labour wages in terrible conditions. And this really was one of those sort of marvellous globalisation con tricks where all of the conditions that the miners had fought for centuries through the unions to get decent conditions here were undermined by closing them all down and importing this cheap coal from countries where workers had absolutely no rights at all.
Well, during the strike itself, the main source of coal which was used to break the strike was Poland. And Poland still does have quite substantial coal mines, not very profitable, but they can't get rid of them because they don't know what to do with the people. I mean, they could make them all redundant and then they'll all turn up in Western Europe saying, give us a job. In Colombia, we had people from Colombia Solidarity, we had people from the Carajás mine come over, and they were very, you know, there's several hundred workers in this mine, which is, for the size of it, is not very many, and it's totally mechanized. The guys that came over to Britain, they drive these enormous trucks like they have in Australia, just massive. You know, they're huge trucks which carry the stuff. And the real problem with the Carajás mine in Colombia is that the indigenous population that used to live where the mine is were all driven out. And, of course, it's very, very polluting. It's, okay, well, the water table is polluted and so on.
The Eye paper is saying that the Whitehaven Colliery in Cumbria is likely to be scrapped as part of the COP26 climate change summit in Glasgow this November. So I guess that will please Greta. But at the end of the day, it makes us reliant on either nuclear. In fact, almost a lot of this seems to be, you know, sort of trying to push us down the road to it's nuclear or nothing.
Well, Amory Lovins from the Rocky Mountain Institute wrote a paper which came out in the 70s, and that, to my mind, is the definitive view on this. And he pointed out that the real problem is not that we've got to find other sources of energy, we've just got to make our technology energy efficient. And it's not even that difficult to do. We're just not prepared to do it.
Well, thanks for making that point. I should have done it, Martin. You're absolutely right. It's very, very important, because that's...
We should just be reducing the amount of energy we use.
That's exactly right.
Therefore, we don't need to have nuclear
Exactly. You know? So this is one of the main points being made in this Bright Green Lies film, is that we need to reduce our consumption of energy, reliance on energy, reduce our travelling to work every day, all that sort of thing. And that's and that is simply not happening. What's happening is that all of that energy is now being done by renewables rather than non-renewable energy. So that means actually a lot more of the things like forests, etc., are going to be cut down. Well, they are already being cut down. Actually, I was noticing there's a lot of trees being cut down by the side of the road, but this is nothing to do with all this. We keep hearing about lots and lots of tree planting going on. The Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees talking about planting trees, the Green Mayor candidate planting trees, and yet the ash right across the country, which is probably something like 20% of all our trees, is dying. It's dying at an incredible rate. And what we're seeing is the verges of our roads right around Britain. And I've been driving through the Cotswolds recently, and loads of roads being closed off because all the ash down the side of the road is dying, Martin. It's rather like Dutch elm disease was in the 1970s. Ash is basically history.
Yes, and of course, after 1973 and the oil price shock, the Japanese started to develop much more energy efficient cars. But it didn't take off in the US at all. And you see them driving around in Bristol all the time. What are essentially off-road vehicles with absolutely ludicrously high energy consumption. And they are regarded as a status symbol in many of the areas in Clifton which have voted green at the last election. And that's just ridiculous. You should insist that all cars reach certain energy efficiency levels. That's it.
Well,
people shouldn't be allowed to drive cars that are not energy efficient.
Well, I don't know how energy efficient my car is. It's not energy efficient enough for Marvin Rees, because it's not the most, as we were hearing from the taxi drivers, it's only cars built within the last 4 years that come up to the very top standards. So we've got this bizarre position, and I think, I'm looking at you here, Martin, with your car, that only if you've got a brand new, absolutely top-notch car that you've paid a fortune for, are you going to be exempt from the tax. Now, that makes
mine's a very small petrol car, and the tax I pay on it is quite small as a result.
That makes it a regressive tax, doesn't it? So people with the wrong type of old car don't pay it, but people with brand new cars do. Other way around, sorry.
This is a fundamental problem for green desires to help the environment.
It's not social justice is what I'm trying to say.
Well, yeah, but
it's the poor pay more.
Well, exactly. If you're going to have an environmentally friendly policy, let's just say we're going to get rid of battery chickens so that chicken becomes more expensive, you've got to increase benefits. You've got to raise wages. You've got to tax the wealthy more. If the Chinese are going to reduce their global carbon footprint, they need to industrialise, and that means there needs to be a resource transfer from the wealthy in the West, taxes increased on them, to pay for nursery schools in China. Is that going to happen? Probably not. There's going to be a showdown of some sort, But it's, we're not going to cooperate on that kind of level, are we?
Well, I'll put a link up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to the review and the trailers for Bright Green Lies. I found it absolutely fascinating. Read the reviews and all the different views, including this basic one where we're going to have to just carry on our same lifestyles we've got now, using, you know, burning up trees rather than coal. Just doesn't seem to make any sense anyway. So it's called A Brief Review of the Film and its Deep Green Message by Paul Mobbs. Excellent review there. But I thought we'd wind up, Martin, with having a listen to Arthur Scargill. It's lovely to hear him again. And I did feel like he was an absolute hero back in the 1980s particularly, which I can remember seeing that strike really well, especially since he was being undermined from within by the security services. And, you know, that what they did was absolutely appalling, I think, to destroy that entire industry as a strategic decision by the Americans as well. You know, there's an international decision.
It was not so much the industry, it was the union organisation that they wanted to break.
I think that's true, yeah.
And, of course, they then basically defang the trade unions.
I think someone somewhere, maybe on the moon, had decided they're going to deindustrialise the whole country, and these are the people they're going to have to smash to do it.
It wasn't just they wanted to financialise the economy, and, you know, get
privatise all this stuff.
Yes,
yeah.
Well, and therefore make it unviable in the form in which it evolved.
The banksters can just buy it up or sell it at their pleasure, you know, and destroy it if they feel like it. Anyway, so it's no longer going to be a strategic industry for the nation, which I suppose is a way of undermining the nation too. But anyway, Arthur Scargill now on nuclear power from this interview on the Guardian website from 2008.
What's wrong with nuclear is that it's absolutely deadly. It's caused the death so far of over 100,000, or will have, within a 30-year time span from the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. And I know that because I was on the TUC commission that investigated the Chernobyl disaster. I also was the advocate at the Sizewell Public Inquiry and the Hinkley Point Public Inquiry. And I know the danger and how deadly low level as well as high level radiation is. And I tell you this, there's no question that radiation in and around a nuclear station does result in a 10% increase in leukemia and cancer, particularly amongst children.
So that's Arthur Scargill, former president of the National Union of Miners. Or was he general secretary, Martin, do you know?
I think he was a president, wasn't he?
Anyway, so his views on... I think he's a very... You know, he's tried to embrace this kind of green thing too, hasn't he? The idea that, yes, we understand that coal is dirty and we want to do something about it as well.
Yeah, and of course the point he's making is that if everybody has the same environmental standards, like we've got to have carbon capture if you're going to use coal, then that doesn't allow dirty coal producers to undermine the more environmentally friendly ones. And I think that even if we're thinking in terms of phasing out fossil fuels, and I think we must think in those terms, not just because of climate change, but because, you know, we've got to stop using up the world's resources, then you've got to have a plan which is a transitional plan. And that, you know, so for example, the nuclear industry, if people are working in the nuclear industry, frankly, there's enough work to keep them working for many thousands of years. The nuclear waste we've already generated will require management for many thousands of years to come. So if you're training as a nuclear engineer, there's no danger that if we decide to close down the nuclear industry, that you will be out of a job, because you won't.
Yeah, well, interesting. And these lobbies are incredibly powerful. So anyway, it's time now to wind up our part one. This show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream and over Sunday lunch at camberleysradioqk.com. Join us in a minute as we take our weekly look around the world. Joel. This is probably the first time we've ever played Billy Joel on this programme. But not a bad little song, that, actually, isn't it? Quite a good one. So that's 1989. We didn't start the fire before that. We had the Paisley Abbey Choir and Be Still My Soul. This is the thing we're doing. I thought we'd do every week now. So we have a hymn at the start because we're not getting anywhere near enough of that. I sometimes try and listen to the Daily Service, for example, on BBC Digital. I tried to one day earlier this week. You can't find it anywhere. Oh, this channel's just disappeared today. Sorry, no Daily Service. And also, I think, you know, the general quality of it has been going right down. But the point being that there is a, you know, surreptitious attack on the faith here in the UK, and so I'm doing my little bit by replaying some hymns on here, as we've done ever since, pretty much ever since this Easter. Anyway, so welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. We're looking at 20 times more Palestinians are dead than Israelis over the last week. Another assault, though, by the brave Israeli army on civilian targets in Gaza is beginning, with just hearing on antiwar.com that the Israeli deputy or defence minister is threatening Gaza will burn. And that's because, obviously, the death ratio is not quite enough Palestinians to Israelis. I find it quite interesting the way that the press reports this, is always making it out that Israel says, you know, seems to be the beginning of almost every sentence in the news coverage. And it doesn't seem to occur to them to comment on the fact that 20 times more Palestinians are being killed than Israelis. And neither on the fact that we've got so far 31 at least children, Palestinian children, have been killed. Very brave soldiers, obviously, from the Israeli side doing that. Other items this week, we'll be looking at Colombia and also the back to Palestine, the land grab by the supposedly Jewish state that Britain helped to create over the years. Another Palestine, pro-Palestine charities closed down in Germany, websites closed down and bank accounts seized. We speak to one of the trustees of that charity. We had Mark Sloboda on recently. He's an American who's teaching in Moscow State University. This week we go the other way around. It's Vladimir Goldstein, who's born in Russia. He's now a professor teaching in New York, and looking at the fashion for fake anti-Semitism, amongst other things, including this tension going on, particularly over in Gaza, and also this incredible story on COVID. When we'll then be moving on to talk about COVID. 62 million COVID vaccines contaminated at this company called Emergent BioSolutions in Baltimore, both of the Johnson & Johnson one and of the AstraZeneca vaccines. And I didn't realise, as neither did Dr. Stanley Laham, who we're going to be hearing from again tonight. It's our third interview with the Florida immunologist who's retired. What is the solution that they want to emerge, Emergent BioSolutions, when they've got 62 million vaccines that have been contaminated? This reminds me of the story with the contamination of the test kits with COVID-19 that we had right at the beginning of the pandemic. And it's amazing, really, that these things are even allowed to happen. Stanley and I ask questions about that a bit later on. An NHS app is about to become a vaccine passport, apparently, next week. Whether that really will happen, God only knows. The German government is shutting down the Palestine charity website, as I just said. But then we're taking a special look this week at the Bilderberg conferences. This is one of my bugbears I've been looking at over the last 25 years, really. And Bilderberg, we've had no word on what's happening in 2021, no idea where they're meeting, which side of the Atlantic. We'll be having a discussion, Martin and I, about it, but also be hearing from... particularly from a chap who's called Jake Morphonius. I'm quite certain his surname is based on that film with Morpheus in, isn't it? The Matrix. And a look at the Council on Foreign Relations and Origins of Bilderberg, as well as this whole concept of the Bilderberg conferences spawning the Trilateral Commission, and evidence out by Will Banyan this week, a writer and researcher on the Conspiracy Archive website, looking at how the Trilateral Commission was most definitely decided. I mean, everyone sort of said, oh, well, this is a David Rockefeller project. But if you're going into the 1972 Bilderberg meetings, you can actually see where this idea was first floated and where these supine pliable world leaders wanting to be presidents and things like that go along to Bilderberg conferences went along with it all. But Martin, we've got to start this week with Gaza. I mean, it does look as if this, we were 122 dead, 31 of them children in Gaza, and yet the Israelis are now saying, well, we're going to burn Gaza. Well, it looks like they're already burning it, and they're readying plans for a ground invasion.
Yeah, and I think the Israelis have already knocked back any discussion of a ceasefire. So Hamas, via the Egyptians, have been saying, well, let's have a ceasefire. And the Israelis have said, no, we don't want a ceasefire.
I mean, is this because this war is good for Netanyahu? He thinks he can do well out of it?
I think there's an element of that for sure. But, of course, what's actually happened here is the existing setup has reached a point where, you know, even the small manoeuvre has exploded the situation. So this began, really, with the Israelis trying to remove these families from East Jerusalem.
That's right, yeah, which, I mean, we'll be talking a bit more about this in context, but East Jerusalem was always supposed to be Arab, wasn't it? And that was the way international law still stands, actually.
That's right, and in actual fact, Jerusalem as a whole was never a part of the Israeli state in 1948, and the original Zionist pioneers tried to ignore Jerusalem because they tended to be secular Jews, and they thought that there was an existing Jewish population in Jerusalem which had lived there for hundreds of years, but they weren't particularly Zionist in their orientation.
Well, they say that, look, I mean, this is riding roughshod over international law, but people like Netanyahu would quietly say to their friends, oh, well, we don't care about international law, we follow God's law.
Well, that's what's happened within Zionism. There's an interesting article in The Guardian today about this, because the original Zionist vision for Israel was that it would be a secular state, and it would be based around Tel Aviv, and that they would basically didn't want Jerusalem at the beginning of their campaign to be part of the state. And Jerusalem only became part of the state of Israel, or the West Jerusalem, after the 67 war, which was a war of territorial aggrandizement by the 1948 state. So, in actual fact, the existence of the State of Israel was only recognised by the United Nations in 1948, and it basically was much, much smaller than what the current State of Israel is. And you could argue that that is the only basis on which there should be a legitimate Israeli state.
Well, some are saying that the problems in Jerusalem particularly could spark the destruction of the Al-Aqsa Mosque.
Well, the removal of these families from East Jerusalem has obviously caused a great deal of anguish. Again, you know, they've been living there since 1948. They're people who fled from other parts, ethnically cleansed from other parts of what is now Israel, and they moved to Jerusalem. But now the Israelis are saying that they want their properties to be given to Jewish settlers. It's as blatant as that. You've got to go. We want your properties. And the other thing that happened is that they were going into the Al-Aqsa Mosque during Ramadan and firing tear gas at them, at the worshippers and so on. And during Ramadan, the Palestinian population used to gather in the plaza outside the mosque to just in the evenings, you know, to socialize. And the police were trying to control the entry to the plaza by using, you know, barriers and so on and so forth, and then just firing tear gas into the crowds and then provoking basically.
Well, let's be clear, Martin. It's not just tear gas. It's also
rubber bullets.
It's also steel bullets with a rubber coating.
That's right. Yeah. And of course, all of this is on the back of the situation where the Israelis have basically said, we're not interested in negotiating with you anyway. Well, and of course, at some point, what Hamas have done is they have been preparing what they've done for some time now. And they've basically saying, I mean, I think what may come out of this is another intifada, a third intifada.
Well, Mikko Peled in Mint Press News is saying Israel's pogroms in Jerusalem could spark the destruction of Al-Aqsa. There's every reason to believe the tragic and unbelievable scenario that one of Jerusalem's holiest sites and one of the world's most revered monuments could soon lay ruined in ashes as Zionist forces smile in satisfaction. This is Mikko Peled saying this. The holy month of Ramadan comes to a close. Becoming clear, the violence against Palestinians in Jerusalem has been ramped up in a coordinated effort by the Israeli government, the Jerusalem municipality, the Israeli police, and violent Zionist gangs. Now, that's the way he's putting it as a Jew, but interesting that the Western media is putting the other spin on it. Most of the coverage I've seen is implying that the Palestinians have started this by having rocket attacks, but obviously those rocket attacks haven't come out of nowhere.
No, they haven't. And of course, what you've got to realise is that in international law, if there is no peace agreement, and the Israelis have basically said we don't want an agreement, then the Palestinians are perfectly within their rights to resist.
But this isn't international law, it's the law of the jungle, it's the survival of the fittest.
Well, I'm just saying that, there's no rule that says that the Palestinians have to accept this. They're perfectly within their rights within international law to resist.
Yes, but surely the point here is that the Israeli government and the Israeli military, Netanyahu, Likud party, etc., are trying to provoke a response. So in a way, by responding, they're doing exactly what the Israelis want.
Well, there's, you know, various mealy-mouthed people, including the British government, saying they want both sides to back down. But this is why I mentioned at the beginning that Hamas have always talked to the Israelis, and they're saying to them, well, let's have a ceasefire. But we've got certain demands. For example, the obvious thing that the Israelis could do is to drop this idea of removing these 70 families from East Jerusalem. But of course, if they did that, then they would be seen to giving in to pressure, so they don't want to do that. And in any case, I think they want a showdown. And of course, if they're going to have a showdown that there will be. And of course, what may happen as this develops is that Hezbollah may join the fight from Lebanon, and they've got a lot better kit than Hamas. And they really will be able to bombard Israeli infrastructure, take out airports, ports, railway stations. Yeah, that's what could happen.
In the background to all of this, RT has been reporting that the CIA spying scandal in Switzerland is showing the best way for intelligence services to read your message is to own the platform. Hey, Bill Gates, that might be Microsoft, mightn't it? Or, hey, Eric Schmidt, it might be Android. The CIA's role in the Crypto AG case makes it clear that spies don't need a way into messaging apps, but a secret bird's eye view from the word go. This is far more effective than any backdoor foreign powers may have access to. On May the 12th, the head of Switzerland's Federal Intelligence Service, the Nachrichtendienst des Bundes, the NDB, Jean-Philippe Gourdin, announced his resignation. Local media reports say his departure stems from a falling out with the defence minister over his handling of the Crypto AG scandal. Namely, he failed to inform her about the affair until it was already public knowledge. So here's the intelligence services just simply not telling the politicians what's going on. And thankfully, one of them, in this case, has been sacked as a result. In February 2020, it was revealed that the company which produced encryption machines for use by foreign governments was secretly bought in 1970 and controlled thereafter by the US CIA, as West Germany's Bundesnachrichtendienst. This connivance meant that the pair, and by extension the US National Security Agency and GCHQ, could easily decode any messages sent on Crypto AG's devices. So there you go. All this stuff, which you think is secret, and actually the Americans and the British are spying on the Swiss the whole time.
Well, call me unshocked. We know that this has been going on for a very long time. It's very rare that it gets exposed, but if anybody thinks that their private communications are private, then I have a suspension bridge to sell them.
But surely, you know, the idea here really is that these big technology companies have been being used for, in this case, in decades. Allegations, the article goes on to say, and this is on SOT.net, Signs of the Times, that the company was compromised to some degree by Western intelligence had swirled on for many years. In March 92, suspicions to this effect on the part of Iranian intelligence led to the arrest of Crypto AG salesman Hans Bula in Tehran. Completely unaware of his employer's ultimate owners, the luckless staffer was nonetheless detained and interrogated for 9 months, only being released after the company paid a $1 million ransom. Now, this is interesting, isn't it? It looks like the Iranians have been trying to tip people off as long ago as 1992 that this was going on. But there was a blind eye was turned to it in Switzerland.
Well, I mean, the Swiss, as you know, have a kind of semi-detached relationship to the Western powers. Lots of dirty money. They've got very, very big washing machines in Switzerland, as a Swiss woman.
And great big mountains to hide all the gold under.
Yes, and we just wash all of the dirty laundry for the whole world, she said to me. And, of course, that's pretty much what we do as well. But if you really want secrecy, you have to go to Switzerland rather than the city of London.
Really? Why? Why is it more secret there?
Because that's their market niche. If you like, if you want cheap and cheerful, you come to the city.
I remember
of London.
We did an interview a while ago. Where
if you want really secret,
where
you go to Switzerland.
If you want to know balance on your Swiss bank account, for the people that really want to hide their money away, as Switzerland is a tax haven, if you want to get your balance, you cannot phone up and get your balance on telephone banking. You can't log in on the internet and get it. What you have to do is pay for a bank official to come fly to Britain to meet you and then to show you on a laptop what your balance is, and then you can write it down, and then they fly back again. That's the only way they trust it.
Yeah, well, I mean, that's for their niche, isn't it? Has been for a long time.
And that's why, I suppose, you're paying a bit over the odds for all that secrecy, to make sure that no one ever finds out how much money you've got there.
Yeah.
How much money have you got in Swiss bank accounts, Martin?
I can't afford to find out.
Anyway, looking at Press TV as well on what's going on over in Palestine, they're saying the Palestine missiles herald a new page in the history of Muslim world, says Emiri in Iraq. A senior politician with Iraq's anti-Israel resistance movement says the missiles that fellow Palestinians are today raining down on the Israeli-occupied territories herald an end to the regime's invincibility myth and a new chapter in the history of the Muslim world. So some are quite pleased that there's some fighting back against the Israelis, particularly for these requisitions of the houses in East Jerusalem.
Well, another factor involved in this is that there was going to be an election to the Palestinian Authority, which hasn't happened since, you know, over a decade. And, of course, Hamas won the last election to the Palestinian Authority, which then caused a split within the Palestinian movement. Abbas has now called the election off. But nevertheless, Hamas, by doing what they're doing, are demonstrating their capability to hit back at the Israelis. They're obviously taking a lot of punishment inside Gaza, but of course the Israelis aren't really used to being under fire themselves. You know, they see themselves as a great big gated community where they can carry on doing what they want to do without taking any notice of the Arab majority around them. But suddenly they're finding that, Hamas clearly have a much higher capability than they've had in previous confrontations. And they're not running out of missiles either. They've got plenty of missiles to fire. And I was reading earlier that they said we're only using the old stuff. They don't even know that the new stuff we've got, we haven't got to that yet.
Well,
and also the other thing they've got, which is very important, is Cornet anti-tank weaponry, which is presumably ultimately from Iran, which means that it can take out the tanks.
Now, have you got some sort of demonstration going on about...
There's a demonstration in Bristol. There's a demonstration going on all over the country, but there's one in Bristol tomorrow at Castle Park at 2 p.m.
Okay, so that's Saturday. I think there's also one at the same time, which is an anti-lockdown march, which they've asked me to speak at. It's roughly the same time. So maybe, you know,
well,
you and I can shuffle between
the
two.
This one is at Castle Park.
I think a bigger demonstration, as I see on Vanessa Bealey's Twitter feed, and Sharmeen Narwani is reporting, there are big demonstrations in downtown Amman in Jordan, cities across the country. Even the state TV is covering these live, which it often doesn't. That's in Jordan, Martin.
Yeah, well, I think what may happen here is we're going to have a Middle East war. That's what's going to happen. Because what could happen here, if Hezbollah get involved, then the Israelis will attack Lebanon. Then the Syrians may get involved. It may be the time people have decided it's time for people to stand up to the Israelis. And they may not win, because they didn't win in 2006 when they went into Lebanon. Hezbollah basically thrashed them. And Hamas have now got the anti-tank weaponry that Hezbollah had back a decade ago. So if they try and get into the Gaza Strip, they might find they're starting to lose tanks. So
yeah, the Israelis believe that Jerusalem is for Jews.
Well, that is the policy of the right wing in Israel, which is predominant at the moment. The original Zionists, as I say, weren't that interested in Jerusalem.
I mean, I'm talking exclusively for Jews. Jerusalem is exclusively for Jews.
Yes, in other words, what's happened to the Zionist project is that in the 40s and the 50s, they weren't that interested in Jerusalem because Jerusalem represented old-fashioned Judaism. There was a Jewish community that lived there for hundreds of years. They weren't particularly Zionist-oriented. And they, you know, from the point of view of the Zionist radicals, they were backward-looking, old-fashioned sort of Jews. So they didn't, in fact, want to take Jerusalem. But in the 60s, they ended up taking West Jerusalem, which, of course, they've got no right to in international law any more than, you know,
Serbia's got the right to Kosovo. We're going to be hearing from our various contributors on the topic in a minute. But Martin, where do you stand on this line? If you were advising Hamas and people like that, Arabs around the Middle East, about what to do about these East Jerusalem and the problems of Al-Aqsa Mosque and the, you know, these evictions and this sort of thing, it's whereabouts do you stand on this line between action and non-action? Because it almost seems as if there is a deliberate provocation going on, and all the Israeli government and armed forces want to do is to use this as an excuse to escalate things. And they know that they're far more powerful, that their army is, you know, facing basically children throwing stones.
Well, I think what's interesting here is that they presume that Hamas wouldn't do what it's done. So Hamas knew that the Israelis were going to provoke. The timing at the end of Ramadan, just on Eid al-Fitr, as the Israelis are trying to provoke something, but they've bitten off more than they can chew. Because in actual fact, they can't stop Palestinians raining rockets down on Israel. Now, of course, that means that the people in Gaza are going to take a hell of a beating. But don't forget that the people in Gaza voted for Hamas. So it's a bit like Britain in World War II. Just because the Germans were bombing Bristol doesn't mean we're going to give up. And I think they've reached that point. The Palestinians, there's a third intifada coming here. In other words, we're now going to fight with whatever we've got to hand, because we haven't got any choice now.
Well,
we've reached the turning point. This is like the Alamo or whatever. We've just got to have a go. And of course, what they're hoping to do is pull all these other forces into the battle as well.
Well, hang on,
Hezbollah,
because the United
Syrian
States
army,
no,
the Russians.
No, but what about diplomacy? Hang on a minute, because the United States has delayed the UN Security Council meeting on the Gaza violence. Blinken, the new boss of the State Department over there, is claiming the US delayed the meeting to find time for diplomacy. But Israel has rejected Hamas's truce offer and is intensifying the airstrikes, blocking two statements at the UN Security Council on the ongoing Israeli violence against Palestinians. The US has objected to a planned meeting on the Israeli bombing campaign that was to be held publicly on Friday.
Well, that's what I said earlier. Hamas have always held out, we will negotiate on a ceasefire, which is what happened previously.
The US are suggesting next Tuesday.
Yeah, and the Russians...
A lot can happen before then.
The Russians have also said that they will act as mediators if that's necessary, so they've been talking to the Hamas leadership. I don't think the Hamas leadership will go for... If there's a ceasefire to be had, they will go for it. But it does mean that the Israelis have got to back down, for example, on removing these families from East Jerusalem. And if they're not prepared to do that, then there's no negotiation to be had, and there's just going to have to be a war. Now, the Israelis have got lots of powerful forces, but don't forget they don't like taking casualties. They're just not used to it. And if Hezbollah...
Well, they have this thing about the kill ratio, don't they? They like to have about, at the very least, 20 to 1 kill ratio. So they want to kill 20 Palestinians for every one Israeli that
gets
killed.
As I say, the key to this is what happens. Hezbollah in Lebanon have cancelled all leave for their military some weeks ago. And if they start firing at Israel, it's going to make what Hamas are able to do look like a Sunday afternoon
tea
party.
But this idea of having something like a 20 to 1 kill ratio is a recipe for massive escalation, isn't it? Every one Israeli that gets killed, you're then going to go and kill, you know, 20 kids. I mean, what about this whole business of the army facing, you know, unarmed civilians and children?
Well,
another
factor that hasn't been, that you haven't mentioned, is you've got all these Jewish mobs rampaging around trying to just kill Arabs at random inside Israel, and the Arab Israeli population basically turning towards an intifada. So you're going to have, I mean, the second intifada was started by Ariel Sharon storming into the Al-Aqsa Mosque with loads of military, and that provoked the Palestinians into a resistance. We've got a whole generation since then, and a new generation is coming forward and saying, well, all of this, you know, there's only one way to deal with force like this that the Israelis are, you've just got to fight them. And of course, we'll have to take terrible casualties, but the Israelis will have to take terrible casualties too. They will lose less, but it hurts more, because they're basically cowardly middle-class people who are not used to taking casualties.
Well, there's a charity called Worldwide Resistance Help, also called WWR Help. Now, their website is down at the moment, but I managed to speak to Mike Farrar, who's over in Wales, who is a son of a Palestinian, who's part of that charity. And I thought I'd start by asking him about a bit of the historical background from 1948 to now, how we got here.
56% of the land was allotted to the proposed Jewish state, and only 44% to the future Palestinian state. Bearing in mind the entire population of the Jews at the time were a minority anyway. According to the Survey of Palestine, which was reduced in 1946 by the British mandate, 33% of the population were then Jewish, while 67% were Palestinians, Christians, and Muslims. 6% of the land was owned by Jews, with Palestinians and others owning 94%. The British suppression of the Palestinian right to self-determination and the encouragement of the Zionist colonialism led to increasing violence in Palestine between Zionists and Palestinians, as well Palestinians, as well against the British, as well as against the British occupiers. That was in 1946, and then you go up to, this only goes up to 2011. So it says in 2002, Israel started to build the illegal apartheid wall, largely on Palestinian land. When complete, it's now completed, is 723 kilometers long, and it's designed to take control of the water resources on the West Bank, confiscate swathes of Palestinian territory. Which is carrying on today. In 2005, Israel dismantled the small settlements in Gaza while controlling, this was 2005 when they left the Gaza Strip. They dismantled the settlements they had, and that's when they elected Hamas, democratically elected Hamas, then they implemented the barbaric siege that has been going on literally for, is it 15 years, 14 years? I just lose count, with periodic episodes of what can only be termed as what the Russell report refers to as a mass extermination of people on the perpetrator on the Gaza Strip. And again, you've got a situation. What would you do if you lived in the Gaza Strip? Your travel is you're a prisoner. And even David Cameron said it was the largest concentration camp in the world. You've got a trapped population, ever growing, just above 2 million now, with no. The population's growing, but the land mass is becoming unlivable. Well, it is unlivable. It was declared unlivable about 2 or 3 years ago. 95% of the water, not higher than that, 8% of the water is completely undrinkable, everything, including the calorific count per capita of the people in Gaza, is calculated to be just below your daily amount. So they're basically only allowing in enough calories to keep you just above starvation levels. I'm sorry, I am utterly, utterly, utterly speechless as to how anybody in the West can justify this to me.
Yeah, that's a pretty good summary of the situation. And if you're in Gaza, you know, we had Fabian Breckles, who's just been re-elected to the council here because he'd visited, and he said, well, the problem for Gaza, because he visited both Gaza and Israel, he's saying, well, you know, you can't win. You know, they're obviously got you by the short and curlies. They're starving you. That if you fire rockets at them, they're going to pulverize you. You've just got to accept that the Israelis are too powerful. But of course, there's also a counter argument, which is we've got nothing to lose here, absolutely nothing to lose. We're just going to fight now, and that's it.
I mean, you do think it's amazing that people have got the courage to fight when they're basically unarmed. I mean, they've got some of these rocket things.
No, they're not unarmed. This is the point.
Okay,
I mean,
go on. Hamas
is Hamas.
Because it's almost all civilians that have been killed.
Indeed, but also the Israelis have been relatively successful in taking out some of the people they want to kill. But of course, what's really shocked the Israeli establishment is how effective this barrage by the military wing of Hamas has been. The previous rocket attacks from Gaza have literally been pinpricks. This isn't the case. They've hit all over Israel, for example, even in northern Israel. The rockets have been able, and they've supposedly got this iron dome, which protects the Israeli population from rocket attack, and it's clearly not worked. And of course, as I said earlier, the real strategic problem for the Israelis is that Hezbollah have got much better kit than the Palestinians in Gaza. And if they are drawn into the battle, and they may well be, then the whole civilian population in Israel is going to have to live in bomb shelters going forward.
One of the most horrific sides of this is that the basic attempts to get basic aid to these Palestinians are also being thwarted. And Mike, as I said, was part of this charity, which have been basically closed down. And he describes here what's been happening with the because they're based in Germany. It's basically the German government which have just said, "Well, we're considering that you are some sort of fundamentalist terrorist organization." Where actually, all they're doing is trying to get a few pennies to these Palestinians so they can do things like cook and things like this. So, but yeah, anyway. So let's have a listen to Mike now talking about the way their charity's been closed down.
It's like people coming in and just stealing everything. Literally, the state stealing your personal PC, everything, you know. So imagine if you lost your iPhone, how that would screw up your life. They took everything and they've not given it back to her. This is the German so-called democratic state. Well, now, because they've had 2 years to try and find evidence on WWR, clearly they haven't found any, because if they had, we would be behind bars. What did they do? They raided a rerun. 2 years later, armed raids again, like deja vu. And all the newly replaced kit, the computers, the iPhones, this, that, and the other, gone. And what is the crime? What is the crime? The crime is charity to Gaza. The crime is humanitarian aid to Gaza. The crime is that you may be working on a project, and in the back, someone's seen a Facebook post with WWR, and they've seen a symbol of Hamas in the same picture. That, what? I mean, seriously, where is the justice? I said to Thomas Eggers, I said, are we led to believe now? Because we are now officially, according to their Minister of Justice, whatever, we are a banned organization. And so I said to Thomas, who is on the board, I said to him, am I now led to believe that in the democratic free state, the democracy of Germany considers it fit and due process to simply conduct trial by media, Facebook, and decree? Because now we've been wiped. We haven't even been allowed. Oh, and by the way, all our bank accounts are seized. This is the other thing. We can't even employ lawyers to defend our case. They've seized our accounts.
Yeah, well, I mean, the German government has got a particularly bad record in relation to the Palestine issue, because the establishment in Germany feels as if they owe the Jews, as they see it, for the terrible things that happened in Germany in the 30s. And then, of course, their conscience is being played out on the bodies of the Palestinians.
They've actually given them several nuclear-armed submarines, haven't they?
Indeed. And, of course, as we know, there's been a global campaign, as David Miller will tell you, by the Israeli state to delegitimize all criticism of the Israeli state. So we're in a very extreme situation. I think it's going to be very interesting to see how British politicians jump on all this one. It's quite clear that the right wing of the Labour Party and further right are all going to be wringing their hands and going on about how terrible it is that Israelis are dying here. Meanwhile, I think general public opinion in this country, when they see what's happening, is going to be rather the opposite. And that's going to be a big political divide in this country.
Well, I mean, what you mentioned there, David Miller, this is Bristol University, supposedly prestigious university, right at the heart of this struggle. And also, in the same week as the Queen's speech, has been announcing, we need to make sure there's freedom of speech in our universities. And yet here we are, as someone who's telling things like they are, who's facing the sack.
Yes, because it's just a load of nonsense, isn't it?
He's not allowed to speak about it, by the way. He's not allowed to speak about this.
So we want freedom of speech for people we agree with.
The university have said that, you know, if you speak about this, and his lawyers have said, if you talk about it in public, and you even reply when there's smear campaign articles written about you in the national press, then, you know, you could lose your job. So he's been advised and told, basically, you've got to shut up. But he's, you know, and he's... So it's all about freedom of speech, but he's not allowed to have any freedom of speech in even discussing what's happening. I mean, I find this absolutely incredible, and it's amazing the way that Bristol seems to manage to be in the middle of this struggle, even though this is something that's going on thousands of miles away in and around the Middle East.
Yeah, I mean, we've got our role to play here in this city. And, you know, obviously, I mean, I've seen lots of posters. I think there's going to be quite a big turnout tomorrow for this demonstration. I think what's going to be very interesting is as when Israel invaded Lebanon in 2006 and killed loads of people, public opinion in Britain was pretty hostile to what they were doing. And I think that that is definitely going to be the case this time too. And it doesn't matter how much the government, who are very much in the pocket of the Israeli government, go on about this, they're going to be seen to be basically on the wrong side here.
So, Elbit Systems, the controversial arms firm with a factory in Oldham, Israeli one, that supplies equipment to the Israeli military too, has just got a contract for over £100 million from the government here in Britain to supply battlefield technology to the UK armed forces. So, these guys are, you know, all over the British. I mean, if the Israelis wanted to switch off the British armed forces systems, they've now got an ideal route to do it because they're buying all their kit to do their fighting.
Well, we also know that the Mossad are very heavily involved in the promotion of false flag terrorism in Western countries like the US and Britain. And, of course, our own intelligence services are in cahoots with them. But, you know, I think that we're reaching an inflection point here. We've had the war in Syria going on for 12 years now. The situation in Lebanon is absolutely critical. The economy's collapsing. The Western powers are pushing to try and overthrow the existing government in Lebanon. And I think that what's beginning to happen is an understanding. The Israelis, of course, don't want any change in the Iranian nuclear deal. And they basically they've reached the point where, you know, there comes a point where you've got to actually go now, and it's time. The time for a fight is now.
Well, of course,
it's all very well saying we all want peace, we all do, but ultimately
people don't.
Well, yes, well, in that case, you have to fight them, don't
especially
you?
If they think they can gain politically out of it or financially. I don't like to pick up Bristol's role too much, but the World Socialist website is doing it for me. They are saying basically this attack on David Miller is actually at the spearhead of the international anti-Semitism witch hunt.
It is, and of course it's to his great credit, and to that he's been targeted in this way. Bristol University, I think, are going to be really in a difficult position, because if they don't behave properly, he's going to be in a position to sue them. And, of course, they're being put under pressure by the Tory government. You can quite see that the Tory government is going to be pro-Israel in this conflict here. And they're going to say that anybody who criticises the Israelis is anti-Semitic. It's not the case. It's not the case. And, of course, it was Britain that's pushed this idea of R2P, responsibility to protect. When is the RAF going to stop the Israelis using airstrikes on Gaza? That's what we did in Libya. That's what we did in Bosnia.
Let's just look for a minute at David Miller, as he's a Mr. Bristol man. A union of Jewish students dedicated to fostering an enduring commitment to Israel amongst Jewish students and the recipient of funding from Israel, along with Conservative and Labour Friends of Israel MPs, have demanded the university investigate David Miller. The Jewish Chronicles thundered that he had no place on any campus, saying when academics moved from research and inquiry, however controversial, to what amounts to intimidation, attacking one group of students, a line is crossed.
Well, that is a load of nonsense, isn't it? And at the same time, the Tory government...
He is attacking those students, isn't he? He's saying that you're just tools of the Israeli state.
Well, they've also said that they are funded by the Israeli state. They're not funded by their own... And in any case, I've got no problem with their views. They just can't enforce their views on David Miller.
They claimed, in a deliberate distortion, says the World Socialist website, that in one of his lectures he criticised Israel for wanting to impose its will upon the world, and had said that some Jewish students were being used as political pawns by a violent, racist foreign regime, whereas he'd warned of the potential harm caused by the Union of Jewish Students in its highly partisan campaigning for Israel and for Zionism. They were particularly incensed because Miller had shown the links between various Zionist organisations in Britain, such as the Community Security Trust, the Britain-Israel Communications and Research Centre, and Union of Jewish Students, to the Israeli state. So really he's tracing follow the money, and he's being persecuted for it.
Yeah, I mean, what he said there is absolutely... I mean, the Union of Jewish Students would not deny that they take money from the Israeli government. They're pro-Israeli. They're pro-Israeli government. The Israeli government funds their activities. I don't even have a problem with that. But they can't shut up David Miller when he points that out. Although they can, because this Tory government doesn't believe in freedom of speech. They believe...
So why is it the Queen? The Queen does. She was saying it just on Tuesday this week in her Queen's speech.
Well, that's because this whole thing about freedom of speech is a complete... you know, it's a disgusting reversal by the Tory government. They're trying to force universities to sign up to this international definition, so-called, on anti-Semitism, which has no legal basis. And, of course, quite a lot of universities, including Bristol University, refuse to sign up to it because it's not legal. And if they try and enforce it, people are going to go to court and overturn it because there are human rights laws which protect freedom of speech, which do not allow you to silence people who are critical of the state of Israel. This is, and David Miller is quite right, the campaign by the Israeli government using the money they get from the US government to stop freedom of speech in British universities and elsewhere on what's going on in Israel-Palestine is exactly
so
that, what it is.
So have they asked you to speak tomorrow here in Bristol, Martin?
That's a shame.
If they haven't, then you're shaking your head.
Yeah, there's plenty of people
I'm
going
sure
to be there.
I'm sure there will be, anyway. So that's Castle Park, 2 o'clock tomorrow here in Bristol. But as I said at the top of the hour, we had Mark Sloboda on the other week talking. He's very, I think it's a lovely little thing to do this, because Mark is an American who's teaching at Moscow State University. Vladimir Goldstein is a Russian, and he's teaching in New York at Brown's, I think it's Brown's University it's called, in New York. And so I asked him about what he makes of the Middle East tension, and also a bit about the Cold War, and finally about this whole idea of is it really anti-Semitism, or is it fake anti-Semitism that's just being used for political ends and being repeated by a pro-Zionist media here in the West?
Unfortunately, we probably should go back again to the such a sad, you know, event as collapse of the Soviet Union. I have a good friend of mine who formulated very well that Soviets were the first to lose Cold War, and the West is the second one. So, you know, what's important is, you know, we all know that to have some kind of a balance of power. And we had, you know, Russia, who would can sort of say, be there, and Russia is very much directly related to Middle East, it's closer to Middle East, you know, and China and United States, then they can sort of sit together and, you know, more or less direct all the plans. With the collapse of Soviet Union and withdrawal of Soviet Union from international affairs at that moment, we basically have United States, which allows Israel to do anything they want. And, you know, so the voice of Arabs, the Arabs are more or less were left to themselves to fend for themselves, as opposed to sort of before that, at least there was some kind of balance of power. And balance of power, it might be we might complain about, you know, Soviet supporting certain kind of dictators and Americans and other ones, but at least there was some peace. And there is, you know, always like to this, you know, old proverb that bad peace is better than a good war. So, but now we have all the chances for a good war. That is, you know, the Soviets, you know, they probably, Soviets and Chinese should be brought in, and they should sort of argue and represent the interest of all the players in the region, outside countries, you know, Palestinians from outside Israel, within Israel. They have to be heard, because otherwise we basically have the same unfortunate situation of the same narrative, American-driven, sort of Israel-driven, bad Palestinians, and victim Israelis. And I agree with you, situation is much more complicated. For starters, you know, a lot of Palestinians are treated as second rate. They feel that they are second rate, and they don't have, very frequently they resort, as people in despair, they resort to desperate actions. This desperate action, if somebody taunts and teases you, whatever, you might in anger grab a bottle and hit it. And then somebody makes a picture of you hitting somebody and say, well, what an awful person. But, you know, people don't consider the background of it, that you know, Palestinians, a lot of Palestinians are driven to despair. So I think, you know, I wish there would be as you said, that we need more diplomacy. Biden should probably bring Putin, should probably bring Chinese, should bring other leaders, and they have to talk and bring some kind of resolution. But without it, it will be the same narrative. Anybody who criticizes Israel will be accused of being, you know, kind of anti-Semite support of terrorists. And this is very one-sided. So in terms of what's going on in England, yeah, I remember there was a situation in England when the leader of Labour was immediately just accused for being anti-Semite, for being sympathetic to Palestinian side. And this is two different issues. You can be anti-Semite and not be sympathetic to Palestinian side. You can be absolutely kind of admirer of Jewish people and sympathetic to Palestinian side. But somehow the merging of these issues it's another thing which bugs me about, as I said, you know, anyone who criticizes the West now is Putin bot, Putin stooge. In my time, everybody who would criticize Soviet Union will be CIA agent, fascist collaborator, and so on. So this simplification, this Manichaean wall of dividing of the world into black and white, is not right. It's absolutely kind of abusive, and it's a sign of, I think, is a decline and more contortions and more violence. And that's what we might see in terms of like the whole war in the region. I don't think it will unfold, unfortunately, you know, because the forces are not equal. So there will be, you know, there will be violence until somebody sane will stop it. But
yeah, one of the things that's been going on in the UK, Vladimir, is that anyone that is criticizing the media, saying the media is biased in favor of Israel, is also many people are actually also being accused of saying, well, you're anti-Semitic to say that.
No, that's really silly. It's again, if you just dare to question anything, you know, if you dare to question United States, you know, Ukrainian policy, you're pro-Russian or something. That's basically using labels, using stereotypes, using kind of, you know, threatening language, because we know in post-Holocaust era, you know, the term and anti-Semite is like, it's like the term of, you know, you're a baby killer or something. So this is a charged term, and it should be used sparingly and for a good reason. You know, criticizing the policy of any government is absolutely legitimate. Questioning the policy of any government is absolutely legitimate. So I, you know, It doesn't lead anywhere. What we have to remember is people on the ground there are suffering, are dying, are being bombed, are being threatened, are hiding in shelters or wherever. So that should be stopped rather than sort of, you know exchanging meaningless kind of labels and throwing them at each other.
Well, that's a very interesting, and obviously I agreed with a lot of that. Is he of Jewish origin? I just have to ask that.
Yeah, Goldstein, yes. Yeah, you can almost guess that he might be.
Yeah, well, I mean, there he is.
It was interesting.
A Russian Jew criticising Israel. Is he an anti-Semite?
Absurd. Oh, he's a self-hating Jew, quite clearly.
Yes, it's just absurd.
I'll put the full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk because Vladimir gave us a fascinating account of his leaving of Russia age 23 back in, I think he was in 1979 he left, and he's done a terrific piece which is comparing America today to what he experienced as Soviet Russia, because he's saying, he says, it's like deja vu for me. I'm now feeling I want to get out of America because it's so controlled and so fake, in a similar way to what the Soviet Union used to be, Martin.
Yeah, well, people like him who've got, you know, an international background are able to make judgments about what goes on. That people, you know, only 15% of US citizens have a passport. They never go anywhere. And that wouldn't matter if they've got the media in, basically educated them about the way the world works, but it doesn't. And then they've got, they're the most powerful nation on the planet. Shocking.
It would help if we could have press TV here in Britain, but it's been banned by Ofcom. You know, this is the Iranian state broadcasters, and we get a slightly different view to the whole of the Western media, which is pretty much in lockstep in support of the Israelis, even though, despite the fact that you've got the Israeli army facing down civilians, largely.
Yeah, well, I mean, the control of the narrative has now become a central part of war fighting strategy.
Well, it doesn't, surely the audience, slowly but surely, will be disbelieve it more and more. If you're trying to use the media for propaganda, people just lose confidence and trust in it.
Well, the reason why they use the media for propaganda is because it largely works until it doesn't. What tends to happen is there are shocking transitions where people suddenly realise that their view of the world wasn't what they thought it was, but they don't happen that often. And the Israeli state is extremely proactive in for example, they've when we were on FM, Bristol Community Radio, UK Lawyers for Israel, who are basically a front for the Israeli embassy, decided to try and close down our little show on community radio here in Bristol.
They failed to do that. Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's chummo, Pat Hart, who took over the hostile takeover bid of Bristol Community FM about 5 years ago and booted out the original founders, Phil Gibbons and Joe Schofield. Well, I didn't. Well, bullied them out, I'd say, rather than booted them out. So that's the way things work. And you know, one does wonder.
Yeah, but the point I'm making is that they are very proactive. You know, the Israeli state puts a great deal of emphasis on trying to control the narrative about what goes on in Israel, and they know
it's controlled it on BCFM, all right.
Yes, and they've also controlled it on the BBC, for example. So we've been hearing a lot about clashes between Israelis and Palestinians, and what that is Israeli military and police shooting live rounds at peaceful demonstrators.
You could almost have a campaign called Israel Says, because that's what I hear on the bulletins. I mean, Israel says this, Israel says that, and we don't hear anything about what the Palestinians are saying.
Well, I mean, if you remember the Great March of Return, Hamas and the Palestinians in Gaza decided that they were going to use non-violent tactics, so they were trying to march out of Gaza. Don't forget that many of the people inside Gaza used to live in the villages they can see from behind the wire, which have been taken from them by Israeli settlers. So their villages where they used to live are just over the road. Yeah, they can see them where their farms used to be. So they're trying to march out of Gaza, out of the camp. And of course the Israeli military killed hundreds of those demonstrators, hundreds of them. And that's where non-violence gets you.
Yeah, shot dead, isn't it? Yeah, okay, so again, it's the army versus civilians, which is the way things are done over there. I think what is worrying about this is the mentality amongst Likud and the Israeli leadership that these Palestinians are Untermensch. There's a real echo of Nazi
Absolutely.
Germany.
Well, I mean, you've had mobs of right-wing Jews storming around inside Israel shouting death to Arabs, and it was shown on TV. They dragged this guy out of his car, whether he was an Arab or not, they thought he was an Arab, and they basically, you know, beat the hell out of him on national TV.
Well, the media plays a massive role here, doesn't it, in justifying this stuff over in Israel. I mean, it's partly religious and partly the press, although there is a bit of a opposition press in Israel. It does seem to be pretty
well in actual fact. The opposition press in Israel is more robust than in this country. I mean, you know, things like Haaretz and Beit Salem, the very well-regarded human rights organisation in Israel, said this is an apartheid state.
Yeah,
and we're not allowed to say that, but of course the opposition in Israel are allowed to say it because it's true. Well, ultimately, if there's no two-state solution, this is an apartheid state.
Well, it was one of the Israeli TV channels that reported the school, the religious school, that was actually preaching that Hitler was right, and that, you know, you should see yourselves as a master race, as above the Palestinians and people in other parts of the world who are basically scum. And they reported that on Israeli TV. Nothing reported here about that.
No, I mean, what you'll find is that the people who speak out in Israel itself are often incredibly brave and extremely to the point. I mean, Yuri Avonry, who was a very strong campaigner for peace for many years, he's dead now, but he was originally a terrorist who killed British soldiers to set up the State of Israel. And he said, if I was a young Palestinian, I would be a terrorist. Of course I would.
I'm going to ask you the question again, though, Martin. I think it's the key thing. And I'm not sure of the answer. I'm really not, as to whether the best thing is to actually to start to hit the Israelis in the knowledge that they're going to hit back even harder. It's, you know, it's bound to be an escalation of some sort, surely.
Well, I think Hamas have definitely made that calculation. They have been preparing their military response to the Israelis quietly for some years now, and you can see it's on another level altogether than what they were previously able to do. And that, of course, is because they got the support of the Syrian government, backed up by the Iranian government, who've been smuggling stuff in there, which will allow them to hit back at the Israelis. And of course, what the Israel Haniyeh, who's I can't remember his first name, who's the military commander of Hamas, is saying is that we haven't even brought out our latest kit yet. And there's no danger of that. It seems that as we're speaking, they are still firing back, and they're carrying on firing. They're not running out of missiles. I mean, some years ago, you know, 10 or 20 years ago, they would be firing an odd rocket, and it would, you know, a sort of fairly limited fusillade of rockets, which wouldn't hit anything much or cause much damage. They have shocked the Israelis. The public opinion in Israel is genuinely shocked, because in actual fact, people who thought they were living in comfortable middle-class areas of Israel are dying.
Well, there's a repercussions around the Arab world.
People in the Hamas and Gaza aren't that bothered.
There's repercussions around the Arab world as well, because many of these pro-Western Arab countries, like the Gulf states, the monarchies, for example, the people there are very annoyed about the way that their leadership has sold out to the Israelis.
Well, that's right.
And they're demonstrating now on the street.
Don't forget that the leadership in places like Bahrain and Saudi Arabia doesn't represent the ordinary people. That's why we're in bed with them. That's why the British military are helping the Saudis to kill everybody in Yemen. But the problem for the Bahraini leadership and the Saudi leadership and the UAE and so on and the Qataris is that they haven't got any democratic legitimacy themselves. And ultimately, we could have an Arab Spring, which will bring democracy to the Middle East and destruction to the State of Israel.
Well, that would be interesting. Anyway, look.
Yeah, it would be, wouldn't it? Don't forget the Syrian army have won the war in Syria, and they've also got the Israeli air superiority could be taken away just like
that.
Well,
maybe
the
Israelis
Russians.
Are thinking it's now or never. We're going to have to use our forces to put this down.
Well, yes, and the other side of thinking, well, it's now or never. One of the things that was happening is that the Israelis were attacking ships bringing oil from Iran to Syria via the Suez Canal. But the Russian Navy have now intervened, and they've made it clear to the Israelis, if you carry on trying to sink these Iranian ships, we're going to sink your ships. And the real big player in all of this is, of course, the Russian military in Syria. If the Israelis want to try and take on the Russian military, they may find that although they're the biggest boy on the block in the Middle East, that they're still a second-rate power.
Let's have a listen to our final clip with Vladimir Goldstein. As I said, the full interview will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk late tonight. Here he says, I mean, what I was asking him was, look, the West seems to be on a hiding to nothing with a lot of this stuff, and it's overstretching its power. For example, it's quite dangerous. It's like a cornered tiger in many ways. The United States has been this superpower, and it's basically lost the trade war with China, and it's now facing a sort of possible denouement. Anyway, I asked him what he thought was going to be the future for the West if we carried on this kind of trying to control the population due to using propaganda and projecting military power whilst basically losing what is an economic war.
In 79, when they went to the West, there was a general consensus that Soviet Union will continue. It will continue to decay. It will continue, but it will go on, because people were convinced that they still have enough kind of mechanisms, enough energy, enough of power to go on. But then it's dismantled very rapidly. So, the same feeling here, of course, West has a lot of resources, a lot of know-how, a lot of energetic people. So I wouldn't just dismiss it and I say that they're heading into the dustbin of history. But on the other hand, it's clear that they, at least the way they were doing things, without any drastic kind of rethinking, they are getting more and more irrelevant. So, in other words, you know, what fascinates me nowadays about the West is like fixation of this identity wars on some kind of, you know, the main concern of everyone is Oscars and some kind of TV shows that they don't have enough representatives of all kind of minorities. These are important issues, but I think, you know, we have to face like fundamental issues. Like in Soviet Union, they had to face, are we as a system viable? What can we do to make it viable? The same thing here. You know, the system which allows, you know, Amazon to become rich and some kind of companies to become rich and then impose some kind of an entity politics on the rest of us as a panacea, I don't think it will succeed. You know, my hope in terms of prediction is that there will be enough people who would wake up in the West under the sort of Chinese, you know, domination, and they would present at least some kind of alternative. It doesn't mean that, you know, any system has to have an upper hand. That's what we have to learn. You know, the people, history, culture, tradition, they can develop in their own way. But I think if the West doesn't do anything, they will collapse like Soviet Union did.
Yeah, I think that's quite accurate. I mean, he's not the only person who sees it like that. There's a guy called Dmitry Orlov who writes about, again, a Russian, but not a Jewish Russian, a Russian who fled the Soviet Union. And he says, well, you know, in actual fact, you know, the modern US is in a very similar state to the Soviet Union in the 70s and the 80s, whereby the system carries on, but it's gradually running out of road. And of course, the key to that is things like the dollar as the world's reserve currency. If they lose that, then there's going to be a massive change in living standards inside the United States.
Well, we were already saying last week, weren't we? Something, in fact, a couple of weeks ago, about the Russians preparing to withdraw from the SWIFT payment system. This is basically like a kind of, well, it's not the IMF, obviously, but it's very important when it comes to exchanging money around the world. Yeah. So if, you know, you make a payment or British company makes a payment to a foreign company, it goes through the SWIFT system.
Yeah, well, the other thing, of course, is that the Chinese Communist Party are holding the US national debt. If they decided to liquidate that national debt, they could crash the US economy. Of course, they'd crash their own economy if they did that. But if it reaches a point where it's the survival of the Chinese Communist system or crashing the US economy, then they're obviously going to take...
How robust do you think the Chinese communist system is? Because there's quite a lot of dissent in China too, isn't there?
Yes, well, I mean, that's the problem for both sides. It's a bit like World War One, which became a battle of attrition. Whose society is going to collapse first? The Russians were the weakest link, and there was a revolution.
Well, it was an attrition on and off the battlefield.
Yes, exactly, because the whole population's involved. It's total war. So, the Chinese Communist Party, for example, if the economy starts to go down the drain in China, which it could do just for internal reasons, not just because of the pressure on it, because they've made some mistakes in many ways by allowing property bubbles to develop on the East Coast, which they don't really know how to unravel. So it could be that the Chinese system is actually, William Engdahl's written some good stuff about this, and he's not hostile to the Chinese. He's just saying that there are some weaknesses in the way they run things. But then there's also weaknesses in the way the US runs things. And, you know, as we can see, we're perhaps coming on to COVID in a minute, but the way in which the two systems have dealt with the crisis has been, you know, rather instructive about who knows what they're doing and who doesn't know what
they're
doing.
Well, we're going to crack right onto COVID right now. And the big story of the week, certainly as far as I can see, is this spat between Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci. He's the chief regulator, and many would say the criminal behind the most draconian policies to do with COVID-19. Also, the protocols, which many people believe have killed many people. So, you know, stopping the use of things like ivermectin and chloroquine as treatments, saying, you know, basically threatening to sack doctors that prescribe these things, even though the doctors think that this is the best thing for somebody, and really being part of the kind of vaccine, pro-vaccine Bill Gates program. Anyway, so let's have a listen now to a bit of the exchange between Senator Rand Paul and Dr. Anthony Fauci this week.
So do you still support sending money to the Wuhan Virology Institute?
We do not send money now to the Wuhan Virology Institute.
Do you support sending money? We did, under your tutelage. We were sending it through EcoHealth. It was a sub-agency and a sub-grant. Do you support the money from NIH that was going to the Wuhan Institute?
Let me explain to you why that was done. The SARS-CoV-1 originated in bats in China. It would have been irresponsible of us if we did not investigate the bat viruses and the serology to see who might have been infected.
Or perhaps it would be irresponsible to send it to the Chinese government that we may not be able to trust with this knowledge and with this incredibly dangerous viruses. Government scientists like yourself who favor gain-of-function research...
I don't favor gain-of-function research in China. You are saying things that are not correct.
Government defenders of gain-of-function, such as yourself, say that COVID-19 mutations were random and not designed by man. But interestingly, the technique that Dr. Barrick developed forces mutations by serial passage through cell culture that the mutations appear to be natural. In fact, Dr. Barrick named the technique the no-see-um technique because the mutations appear naturally. Nicholas Baker in the New York Magazine said nobody would know if the virus had been fabricated in a laboratory or grown in nature. Government authorities in the U.S., including yourself, unequivocally deny that COVID-19 could have escaped a lab. But even Dr. Xi in Wuhan wasn't so sure. According to Nicholas Baker, Dr. Xi wondered, could this new virus have come from her own laboratory? She checked her records frantically and found no matches. That really took a load off my mind, she said. I had not slept for days. The director of the gain-of-function research in Wuhan couldn't sleep because she was terrified that it might be in her lab. Dr. Barrick, an advocate of gain-of-function research, admits the main problem that the Institute of Virology has is the outbreak occurred in close proximity. What are the odds? Barrick responded, could you rule out a laboratory escape? The answer in this case is probably not. Will you, in front of this group, categorically say that the COVID-19 could not have occurred through serial passage in a laboratory?
I do not have any accounting of what the Chinese may have done, and I'm fully in favor of any further investigation of what went on in China. However, I will repeat again, the NIH and NIAID categorically has not funded gain-of-function research to be conducted in the Wuhan Institute of Virology.
So that's Dr. Anthony Fauci there. In a way, you know, basically, Martin, what's happening is Rand Paul has picked up on Steve Hilton's work on Fox News at the next revolution that was being done at the end of January, just as Biden was taking over. And he's throwing it right at Fauci, who's having to duck and dive and deny everything.
Yeah, I think the idea that it may have leaked by accident from the Wuhan laboratory is definitely logically possible. But I think by far the most likely possibility is this is a biological warfare attack on China conducted by the US deep state. If you look at the way the Chinese have responded, they've responded as if it was a biological warfare attack. And there's a very good article that our sound engineer Dave Vasanko sent me on Skype last week about exactly this, Godfrey Roberts pointing out that the Chinese, ever since they thought that the first SARS COVID outbreak was a biological warfare attack, and they said,
yeah, Fauci didn't refer to that.
No. And of course, what Rand Paul doesn't seem to get is by going on about how this
they're getting there,
but
I think you've got to give him a pat on the back for putting these questions,
at the same time, of course, people like Rand Paul, who are often thought of as libertarians or whatever, they won't accept that the 9/11 attack was carried out by their own security forces.
It really doesn't matter, because what it matters is that he's asking the right questions to Fauci, and maybe he's nearly there, maybe he's not quite. If you were there you wouldn't ask those questions, but it is important that those questions are asked.
I think
you're nitpicking by having a go at him in this way.
No, I'm not. Because I think that the Murdoch press in particular were pushing the line that this is a biological warfare agent leak.
Nobody else anywhere in the mass media is talking about this. Nobody.
No, I know. That's why I'm perfectly willing to. I'd rather discuss this. And as you say, of course. But the point is, it's as Rollins' article, which I sent you this week, is saying that the obvious conclusion to draw, and I would say this sitting here in Bristol, that the Chinese intelligence services have drawn it, this is an attack on us by biological warfare agents. They must be kicking themselves for allowing EcoHealth to come into the Wuhan Institute for Virology. But there's another potential way in which the biological warfare attack could have been carried out, which was the military games that took place in Wuhan in November of 2019, where you had hundreds of US military personnel wandering around. In fact, some of them showed symptoms of flu and had to be hospitalized. Now, if the Chinese do know that it was an attack on them, they're not necessarily going to broadcast that from the rooftops. They're just going to take the necessary steps to protect themselves, which they have, and prepare for the next phase of World War III, which is what this is.
Well, I'll put a link up to the Inns Review article on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. So let's have a listen now. I think it's looking at the analysis, really, of... Okay, so, you know, giving the idea that maybe this is a deliberately released from the Wuhan lab by EcoHealth Alliance, Peter Daszak, you know, people like that, to try and pin the release of this as a bioweapon on the Chinese. So, obviously, intelligence services have got one view, the mass media have got another, the public have got to try and figure out what's going on. And I thought it would be good to have a chat to Stanley Laham again this week. He's this retired immunologist who lives in Florida. We've had on the show a few times because there's lots of the interesting aspects to all this that aren't really being looked at very closely. And one of them is Haiti, because Haiti has had the island in the Caribbean had a very, very low rate of COVID. It's great to have somebody like him analysing why he thinks it is that so few people in Haiti have died. One of the things you might think is that they've got virtually no healthcare system there. And he says a few things here, which I found absolutely fascinating. Like, it's the rich people in Haiti that have been much more vulnerable to COVID than anybody else. And also that they've got a certain type of tea that everyone drinks there that some people are convinced has helped. But anyway, he gives his own what he thinks is the most important reason. But he starts by talking about this incredible aspect of this COVID-19 pandemic, which has meant that the vaccine companies themselves have been indemnified by the government against any harm they cause, which then has led to this incredible headline this week, Martin, where 62 million doses of the vaccine, possibly one of the ones that you've had, I hope not, have been contaminated. So the vaccine companies are in this ridiculous position of not having to suffer any consequences if they inject people with contaminated vaccines.
Yes, the indemnification of the vaccine companies, you know, that's clearly removing them from, you know, what they would say is, if we don't have this indemnification, we can't produce these vaccines quickly enough, etc., etc. And I've got no problem at all with the big pharma.
It's just about money, really, isn't it? Well, it's not about how quickly you produce it. They're saying, well, we're not prepared to do this. We're not, you know, it's a kind of horse trading thing, really.
Yeah, well, it is.
It's nothing to do with medical
also,
health.
But of course, you've got the Sputnik vaccine produced by the Russians and the Sinopharm vaccine produced by the Chinese, but not under market conditions. They've been produced by the public sector in the two countries concerned. And ultimately, of course, it's not just a question of big pharma trying to sell pharmaceuticals and make money, although they are. It's ultimately about warfare and biological warfare.
So the headline is 62 million COVID vaccines are contaminated at a scandal hit factory. An additional 62 million Johnson & Johnson coronavirus vaccine doses could be contaminated at the factory that was forced to throw 15 million doses away last week because of a production blunder. Quality control managers at a plant in Baltimore, Maryland, operated by Emergent BioSolutions, are now required to test every batch of Johnson & Johnson vaccine produced alongside 15 million doses of AstraZeneca vaccines, which were destroyed after the ingredients were mixed up in the production process. That amounts to screening 62 million doses for possible contamination, the New York Times has reported this week, based on documents and interviews with former workers at the factory and federal officials. In a way, Martin, it's a miracle that this story has actually come out, because these pharmaceutical companies try and keep this stuff all quiet, don't they?
Yeah, and I think, you know, the whole idea of producing vaccines really quickly without testing them properly is inherently dangerous. which is why, of course, the Chinese haven't pursued that policy. They've pursued a policy of isolating COVID, and that have succeeded. And, of course, when the fighting starts in the South China Sea, they will be COVID-free, but the Americans perhaps less so.
OK, well, let's have a listen to what Dr. Stanley Laham had to tell me about this amazing emergent biosolution disaster over in the United States last week.
You would have never heard of a company called Emergent Biosolutions. We wouldn't have known they're the ones manufacturing for Johnson & Johnson and for AstraZeneca in Baltimore. Were you aware, Tony, that some of your vaccines in Europe were being manufactured in Baltimore, Maryland? I wasn't aware of that until this thing happened. And when somebody who's a trained virologist said there were some fundamental mistakes in the steps of producing the virus, what are the mistakes they would have made? That is a lot more worrisome right now than where the COVID-19, Corona 2, the SARS-CoV-2 virus came from. And when you have such mishaps in the fabrication of something that's going to be injected into people intramuscularly that you cannot de-inject, that's much more worrisome. And I think right now the main problem will be, you know, quality control to make sure that there isn't something very unsafe in the vaccines.
Since the government has indemnified these vaccine companies, what motive is there for them to have any quality control?
Well, hopefully not to get too many people sick. That would be the main reason to have good quality control. It is true that they have immunity from civil lawsuits, but there would come a point where people would really be up in arms. The other problem is that certain adverse reactions may not appear until later. So the whole idea of giving the pharmaceutical companies, Big Pharma, immunity from civil lawsuits or criminal prosecution is a bad one. But then we see that all the time. We're living in a bio-industrial environment that's getting harder and harder to control when the controlling bodies that are supposed to regulate them are being directed by people from Big Pharma.
Well, I mean, I think we can distinguish between the disaster capitalists of Big Pharma rushing vaccines through without proper testing and so on, always going to be a problem, and the wider question of what caused the crisis in terms of whether it is or is not a bioweapon and what necessary steps you need to take if it is. I would argue, as I have argued week after week, that if you adopt non-invasive administrative methods for trying to control the spread of the disease early enough because you are worried about biowarfare, which is what the case in China has been, then you don't have to vaccinate people until you're ready and you're sure that they're going to work.
Well, what Stanley is going to be saying in our next clip, but one is talking about the total failure of the flu vaccines to actually do what they were supposed to do, and this possibly being something. Let me finish. Just this possibly being something which is, in order to keep this vaccine industry going, to have another wave of different type of vaccines because the flu vaccines have failed. But the main point I wanted to ask Stanley about was this whole business of, his compensation, which he touched on there, as to, the idea of indemnifying these companies, that we, the government, indemnifying these companies so they can just do whatever they want, produce 62 million dud vaccines, and then they think, oh, well, never mind, because, we don't have to pay the consequences, even if these get injected into people. Luckily, of course, these things have now been picked up before they were injected into people. But I mean, we're being involved here in, you know, this is not standard practice by any means. You know, what is happening is people are being subject to a mass experiment, experimenting on human beings, Dr. Mengele style, because this compensation business. So I thought I'd ask him a bit more about the compensation, and then he went on to talk about you know, this incredible situation, as I said before, in Haiti, which is you know, has virtually no healthcare system, but they've had hardly any problems with COVID.
If you check, you'll find out that pharmaceutical companies pay an average of $2 to $3 billion a year in damages. Now, they've been rendered immune because of the fast track order, because of the great emergency for COVID-19. They are immune from civil or criminal prosecution. This was the agreement between all governments and the pharmaceutical companies that were working on the COVID-19 vaccine. And the reason they were given immunity is because they said, well, if you want it fast, we're going to have to do it fast track without proper testing for 3 years minimum, which it would normally take to test the vaccine. These went on fast track production. They skipped a lot of trials to make it available sooner to the public. And what they asked was immunity from civil lawsuits. I don't think the lethality of the COVID-19 virus required such a step. But then that's my opinion. You had something that had a very low mortality rate. So I don't think there was any reason to skip some of the safety measures in producing a vaccine and making it available to the general public.
If the mortality rate wasn't enough to justify it, why did they do that then, do you think?
You know, sometimes people answer a question by saying this is above my pay grade, but what I'm going to tell you is that I think they did it because of the general panic that gripped the world concerning the coronavirus. I want to point out an article for you that the poorest country in the world, Haiti, had minimal corona deaths, about 50. And yet no masks were used, no vaccination. The government decided there will not be vaccination in Haiti. And yet the population was barely affected. I've spoken to many physicians in Haiti, and they told me they think that one of the reasons this virus did not affect the Haitian population is because of the chikungunya virus that a lot of them had developed antibodies to, that perhaps cross-reacted. They attribute it to perhaps cross-reaction with malaria, or perhaps taking chloroquine as a malaria prevention also prevented bad epidemic. Now, as far as the chikungunya virus was concerned, that explanation is not sufficient because there are other places where that virus was prominent, such as in the Dominican Republic next door, where they had many more cases of COVID-19 than in Haiti. So that remains unexplained. But Haiti has the lowest mortality per 100,000 than any other country in the world. It's a very congested place. The demographically, it's a very dense population. Yet they celebrated Carnival, Mardi Gras, as if there were no virus like any other year. And yet they did not have huge outbreaks of morbidity or mortality. So here's one thing that remains a mystery. And a couple of articles were written that last week, by the way.
maybe we here in the West, with all our super cleanliness and our obsession with health, has meant that we've been rather mollycoddled, and that because the Haitians are subject to many diseases and they've had to build up natural immunity to these things, that perhaps they're better prepared.
Possible. It's very possible. It's such a glaring thing that our local ABC channel in Miami here, Channel 10, had a special report on that. Unexplainable it is that Haiti was not, and yet a lot of people from Miami traveled to Haiti, and most of the cases in Haiti was among the wealthier classes and with very, very low mortality. In Haiti, it seems all of them believe in what they call armoise tea. They seem to take it regularly. They don't even have to pay for it because it grows in the wild. And they make tea with it. And it seems they attribute it to that. But there is no scientific cause and effect showing that this armoise tea is what did it.
Amazing story about Haiti there, Martin, and isn't it incredible that it's possible, according to this ABC channel in Miami, and a Haitian, maybe this is just gossip and silly conspiracy theories, but that some sort of basic simple herbal remedy has helped the Haitians immensely.
Well, it's the first time I've heard of this. It's an interesting, if we were all in an objective world trying to objectively find the truth, it would be worth investigating what's gone right in Haiti that's gone wrong in the Dominican Republic, because they're on the same island.
I would suggest another possibility there is just that the fact that they've got the malaria mosquito has helped, because so many people are taking these prophylactic anti-mosquito tablets to try and, in case they get bitten by a mosquito, very, very cheap, like these chloroquine things, which have this antiviral side effect.
Well, that may be the case. I mean, this is the sort of thing that, we pay scientists to investigate for us.
Big Pharma pays the scientists to investigate things and find that they need vaccines for everything. But anyway, final clip with Dr. Stanley Laham this week is about this fascinating look at the failure of the flu vaccine over the years, and the idea that potentially that the pharmaceutical industry was rather worried that their flu vaccine was proving absolutely useless and that they needed to have some sort of new vaccine. So this may have been possibly a motive for pushing vaccines so much for COVID.
Well, if you look at the statistics from 2010 to 2019, you're going to see that one of the best years was around 2012, when only 17,000 people died from the flu in the United States. I'm not talking globally. I don't know the global figures, okay? Now, in 2017, there's been a campaign, and every year you get progressively more people getting the flu vaccine. And you're going to notice that 2010 was a low year, and then it has increased to 40,000, then decreased again in the following year until 2017, which was the worst year, yet had higher vaccination rates than the previous years, where we had nearly 80,000 deaths from the flu season.
You've got a whole flu vaccination program going on, and yet it doesn't seem to be doing anything to bring the levels of flu deaths down.
That is precisely it. If you look at the statistics from 2010 to 2019, you will see that there isn't really a correlation in the number of cases, that is morbidity or mortality, the number of deaths, with the percent of the population that's vaccinated. The percent of the population that's vaccinated has been constantly growing through their vaccination, the official vaccination campaigns.
Yeah, but I mean, it seems intuitive that if that percentage is growing, then the number of people dying of flu should be dropping.
It is not. That's exactly what I'm telling you. that there is no correlation between the number of people who got the vaccine and a reduction in morbidity or mortality. And that's why I brought this example of the difference between 2010 and 2017. And 2017 was one of the worst years for hospitalization and deaths from the flu vaccine.
Well, that's an interesting hypothesis there, that we've got basically what you would call vaccine failure with the flu vaccine, Martin. There's a lot of people anecdotally told me that having the flu vaccine, they then caught the flu after having the flu vaccine. And also that they often take such a long time to develop that there's a new strain of flu around by the time you've had the vaccine. So it could be here that the pharmaceutical industry is rather worried that the flu vaccine has hit the buffers, that the cat is out of the bag, that it's not really helping.
Yeah, well, there's the two possibilities, isn't it? Is that the vaccinations we're being given for COVID are potentially dangerous. And the other thing is that they might not work at all and we've wasted a load of money. And that's quite possible. I mean, this is what all this stuff about new variants developing, which will basically, I've had an AstraZeneca, I've had my first AstraZeneca jab, I'm due the next one in the next couple of weeks. But it may well be that it won't necessarily do me any harm, but it won't necessarily do me any good. And everybody presumes that we're out of the woods now here in Britain because we've got the best vaccination record in the world. But it may well be that these new strains will come in from Brazil and from India and elsewhere, and it's all back to square one.
Well, this is the problem with relying on vaccines to do the job, isn't it?
Exactly.
Yeah, so I was just fascinated. Stanley's just opened my eyes there to this, sort of crisis, which hadn't been really talked about, going on in the pharmaceutical industry, where they're phoning people up, they're texting people saying, have your flu vaccine, have your flu vaccine. But the evidence is mounting ever since the disastrous flu season of 2017, that the numbers of people taking the vaccines has been climbing and climbing and climbing steadily. But actually, it proved in that year that, and in other years, that the general trend is not being, the flu deaths are not being reduced at all. Just to explain, he's using these terms morbidity and mortality. That morbidity is about whether you get sick with the flu, and mortality is whether you die with the flu. So, he's saying that basically that this flu vaccine program over the last 15 years has ended up, the evidence is now, before the jury. The jury is not out. They've come back and they've said that this vaccine doesn't work.
Well, I mean, the pharmaceutical companies aren't in the business of curing people of anything, are they? They're in the business of selling stuff. And if they can get the government to mandate that you've got to have this vaccine, so much the better. And but whether it works or not is entirely secondary. And of course, the real problem is if it's actually positively dangerous. And it may well be. As we know, the AstraZeneca vaccine, which has been lauded in the Tory press here as the solution for everything, in quite a few other countries, they're not using it because they think it's too dangerous. So you can see what the issues are here. Ultimately, the only real defence against this is to do it properly, as they've done in China and New Zealand.
Well, there'll be,
it's not about vaccines.
This
is
the sort of thing which will be in, not in many mainstream newspapers, but it will certainly be in this thing called The Light, which is a picture of a lighthouse on the front of it. It's called thelightpaper.co.uk. And there's just another edition of that. It's just out, issue 9, which I imagine will be being distributed tomorrow. Up at College Green and various other places. I think there's going to be a march of some sort as well. So you can get a hold of a free copy of that tomorrow if you want. But it's also up on thelightpaper.co.uk. You can download as a free PDF if you want. These vaccinations causing mass sickness in the National Health Service, says Dr. K. Polyakova, who's a consultant. This is she wrote a letter to the British Medical Journal called Rapid Response, a letter which was published and then removed from the website, but it was archived, and her letter has been published in the Light Paper. There seems to be a lot of censorship around this and a lot of lobbying by the pharmaceutical industry to keep certain views out of the not only the mass media, but particularly the specialist media like the British Medical Journal, Martin.
Well, there's a struggle going on. You can see why the pharmaceutical industry has got its own axes to grind, that's for sure. No doubt about it. I mean, the John le Carré book and then film The Constant Gardener is all about what the pharmaceutical industry gets up to in developing countries like in Africa.
But it's getting up to those things here now.
Yes. And of course, all of that may be true, but you've still then got the you've still then got the problem of dealing with, dealing with something, whether it's whether it's deliberately created or accidentally created. I mean, if it's deliberately created, and I believe it is, it's not designed to kill loads of people. It's designed to destroy trust so that economies are destroyed. And that would be the purpose of gain of function research for a biological warfare agent, which would then basically cause a global economic collapse, which is actually the goal of the deep state in the US, because they want to bail out their banks yet again. The banks were already bankrupt before COVID hit. All of these things put the different context on what we're talking about, especially when I mentioned 9/11 earlier. And of course, this is the 20th year, and September will be the 20th anniversary. People have got to understand the evil motivation of the people behind the deep state in the West. They are absolutely evil. That is really the bad news. And it's very hard to get people to understand that they are quite capable of killing lots of people to achieve their goals. They've done it. I mean, you know, after 9/11, they've killed millions in the Middle East. They don't care about the consequences. And that is the world we live in.
Well, one of the things in the light paper, which I rather liked, is a whole page, which is a kind of, looks like a kind of Trivial Pursuit board, where there's all sorts of interesting questions. I do hope, and they better have the answers, to those questions somewhere in the paper, in the text, further in the paper. But anyway, so that's available at, thelightpaper.co.uk. And, I would imagine there'll be plenty of copies, flying around, tomorrow, at College Green, 2 o'clock, where there's a, anti-lockdown demonstration. And Martin, would you just like to remind us where and when the anti-Israeli demonstration?
Well, it's not anti-Israeli, no? It's pro-Palestinian, put it that way.
Right.
We're demonstrating for Palestine. We're going to assemble, I understand, at Castle Park at 2 p.m, and then I think we're going to march through the town to College Green.
I would say the demonstration which I will be speaking at is a pro-health demonstration in many ways. You know, so you shouldn't just see things as anti-something, you know, because it's better to light a candle than it is to curse the darkness. Okay, so we're going to go on now to look at the Bilderbergers, who should be meeting next weekend, or may possibly be the weekend after. But they've disappeared off the face of the earth, Martin. Where are they hiding?
Well, I imagine they've got the same constraints about meeting up in big meetings
as
everybody else.
You really think so?
Well, no, they can.
You really think so?
Presumably, they're having WhatsApp messages with each other anyway. They don't actually have to have a meeting to have a conspiracy, Tony. In many ways, having a physical meeting means that you're actually, people can observe it.
I remember Dan Dix.
If you do it all on the phone, then nobody knows.
Dan Dix rather naively said the same thing. The whole point of these meetings is that promises are made and deals are done face-to-face with no surveillance. In fact, they have a whole team for a whole day going around checking for bugs in these buildings. They can't do it on Skype, can they?
No, but they don't have to get them all in one place at one time necessarily. I mean, it may be useful, and obviously for many years that's how they've done it. But if you can be quite sure that these people will find ways to do what they want to do.
Well, the idea is
without having a meeting.
Your idea is you're making an event of it, you know, and that's part of the seduction. Yes. If you've got all the most powerful people in the world here, who are you to say no?
Yeah, but this is what Webster Tarpley said about Bilderberg years ago. It's not where the line is decided. No. It's where it's where the line is handed out. Lower level people are all gathered together and told what they're going to do.
But it is also, no, I don't necessarily agree with that either, because the idea is what you're doing is you're inviting in a whole load of people who may be potential political leaders in the future. And
that's right.
What you're doing is you're kind of saying to them, well, are you going to be part of this club or not? Because if you start disagreeing with us, then, you know, your political career is over. But you're not saying it. You're sort of it's a kind of dog whistle idea.
Well, it's what they're doing is the political leadership meet up with the real movers
and
shakers.
People know where that's
right. Intelligence services, the pharmaceutical companies, the bankers.
People know which side their bread's buttered when the most powerful bankers in the world turn up. The idea is, if you want to disagree with us, that's fine. But, you know, you're not going to be part of the future if you do.
Yeah, well, that just goes to show how relatively, I mean, there are no doubt meetings that go on that we don't know anything about at all. the Bilderberg meeting is where it's basically the people who go there are being flattered that they are, like Tony Blair, for example, and Clinton and others, Mandelson, they're being flattered that they are important. They're important enough to be invited. And they get flattered by that. And then they, when they get there, they get told, well, we're doing this, this and this. And then they get drawn in. But it's not a place where the real movers and shakers are making the decisions. They've done that before the meeting, a long time before.
Well, I've done my little internet search for Bilderberg 2021. There's absolutely nothing on the internet about it, so that obviously doesn't exist, or else maybe it's just happening in secret, because they only...
Well, as you know, for many years, they pretended that they didn't exist.
Well, many years, we found it very difficult to track them down, you know, so we're talking about 20 years or so I've been following it, 25 years even, and most years it was all a bit touch and go as you were. I mean, it's not that difficult for them to go completely underground and have a meeting that no one knows is even a Bilderberg meeting. In fact, once I think, I remember somebody at a hotel who happened to know a bit about the Bilderbergs was asked to leave. And they said, well, I wanted to stay tomorrow. No, you can't. And they actually realised that there was something going on that was eventually tracked down to becoming a Bilderberg meeting. But it doesn't seem to me to be rocket science for them to be meeting somewhere, particularly with all the kind of COVID measures there are still around in certain parts of the world, you know, secretly. So that may well be happening. Anyway, let's have a listen now to, I mean, we're going to talk in a minute about the Trilateral Commission and the 1972 meeting. But I thought we'd start with this guy, Jake Morphosius. Is it Morphonius, sorry, from Blackstone Intelligence, talking about what he calls the sinister origins of the Bilderberg Group. And before we hear from him, Martin, you know, what he's saying here really is that the Council on Foreign Relations was absolutely behind it. And I remember years ago, God rest his soul, Mike Peters from Leeds Metropolitan University, writing that brilliant piece, The Bilderberg and the Project for European Unification, which really pulled it all apart. He was pinning it down to basically 1943, before the end of the Second World War. That was really when Bilderberg began, because the Council on Foreign Relations already knew that it wanted to have an elite control of, which was welded together, the NATO countries after the war against the Soviet Union. They were really worried that many of the countries, particularly the Italians and other Eastern European countries, were going to be, you know, more sympathetic to the Soviet Union than they were to the United States.
Yeah, I mean, that's pretty well known that that's the history of it. I mean, Italy isn't, of course, in the Eastern Europe.
The connection with Council on Foreign Relations isn't, though, because it was a Council on Foreign Relations War and Peace Studies group that were devising, you know, having long discussions that eventually came up with the idea, well, we're going to have this group. Yeah.
Well, I mean, the point is that the elite in the West, and as we know from other researches that you've done, they integrated into that elite the Nazi intelligence elite, people like Klaus Barbie, you know, Goering, not Goering, what's the one I'm talking about? Martin Bormann.
Oh, Galen, Reinhard Galen.
Etc. And from the at that stage, they were planning what they were going to do to deal with what they saw as the threat of the Soviet Union. And, of course, the Soviet Union had supported partisans in places like Yugoslavia, in Italy, the Communist Party were pro-Soviet at that stage. In France, the Communist Party came to power, you know, they were part of the Gaullist Communist Coalition that came to power at the end of the war. And, the Western elites needed to do stuff to, you know, preserve the Western elite system, which they're still doing. Well,
I find it fascinating that you've got this Bilderberg, the sort of political wing of NATO, being formulated in 1943 before the end of the war.
Well, that's when you would do it, isn't
it? Yeah, I suppose so.
That's exactly the timing.
You're really looking ahead. The idea is you're not going to leave anything to chance, like the idea that, you know, that the Europeans might start making friends with the Russians. Good God, we don't want that. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Jake, Blackstone Intelligence, talking about, particularly about Joseph Rettinger, who was a Pole who was working for MI6, and very closely with the General Sikorsky, who was the Polish leader in exile during the war, but how he actually was involved in this whole project much, much earlier, at the time of the First World War, and carried that on through into the decades of the 20th century.
After the disastrous war to end all wars had snuffed out the lives of tens of millions of expendable commoners, Redinger was chosen to act as a secret courier from the heads of European royal dynasties as they tried to secretly negotiate an end to World War I with Emperor Charles I of Austria. The ceasefire would be given in exchange for the emperor agreeing to vast land concessions, including acquiescing to German territory being sliced away. These scandalous negotiations came to be known as the Sixtus Affair, when it failed, largely because Germany wasn't willing to go along with these outrageous demands. But Redinger's role as an agent of the elite wasn't over. In 1917, he started working on efforts toward a world federal government under an Anglo-French alliance. But the following year, Redinger was banned from France over his political meddling, from Austria to the Soviet Union. They didn't want anything to do with him. By the time World War II came along, Redinger was back in London working with Winston Churchill, who was also deeply connected to the Zionist leaders. Redinger facilitated the transfer of Polish troops out of France to Britain. And when the exiled government of Poland was reestablished in London, Redinger became the chief advisor to that government in exile. And it was during this period that Redinger actually tried to form an immigration network to relocate Polish Communist Party members to London. Now, as you might imagine, the Brits were not so enthused about the idea of bringing Jewish communists to England, and Redinger's plan went nowhere. But before long, he was working on an even more grand effort, an effort to create a Central European Confederation. This was an early attempt at a type of transnational globalist control system, like the European Union would be later on. The idea was to make the newly created Poland and Czechoslovakia the nucleus, and from there more and more states would be brought under control. But when Britain's ally during World War II, the Soviet Union, when they learned of the plan, Winston Churchill had to backpedal. Despite claiming that he was working for the best interests of Poland, the Polish underground army accused Redinger of serving other interests. And he survived an assassination attempt during this period of time, a poisoning that left him lame in one leg for the rest of his life. They didn't like him. After the war, Redinger returned to his earlier dream, though, of establishing a European supranational control system. He was the architect of the original informal Bilderberg conferences that took place from 1952 to 54. He established himself as the group's secretary and served in that position until he died in 1960. A friend of Redinger, a Swiss writer named Dennis de Rougemont, I think it was, he recorded an exchange he once had with Redinger. He said, "Joseph, my friend, they say you're a Freemason, an agent of the intelligence service, of the CIA, Vatican, that you collaborate with communists. Sometimes they even suggest that you're Jewish and gay. What is the truth about you?" And he writes that Redinger laughed and said, "What can I say? That's not even the half of it." So this is the man who formed the Bilderberg Group. And as I said in the beginning, the conspiratorial nature of Redinger's group is not a theory, as shocking as it may be to those who have yet to swallow that red pill of cold, hard reality. The Bilderberg Group and its wicked agenda of evil is undeniably real. The group continues to play a seismic role in the affairs of the Anglo-American Empire. For example, when there was a spike in British nationalism sentiment, which was a direct threat to the European Union superstate run by the elite, the Prime Minister at the time, Tony Blair, was summoned to the 1998 Bilderberg Conference, which was at the Turnberry Hotel in Scotland. And sources who were there leaked that Blair was lectured like a schoolboy for not enforcing the euro currency on his fellow citizens against their will. in lieu of the British pound. The people who serve as the chairman of the Bilderberg Group, these guys are typically in high positions of political power. They are deeply entrenched in the circles of the international bankers. Based on what we know of the membership of the group, it's believed that the group is essentially an international version of the Council on Foreign Relations, a blending of the U.S.-based Rockefeller and Morgan network with the European-based Rothschild network. And so what we know about the Bilderberg Group's inner workings, it's mostly shrouded in mystery. And that's partly because the group maintains this stranglehold over our media by bringing into its fold the power players who control our news. For example, years ago there was this reporter named Sigurd Tether. He wrote for the London Financial Times. He said this: "If the Bilderberg Group is not a conspiracy of some sort, it is conducted in such a way as to give a remarkably good imitation of one." So, not the kind of thing they want out. So, not long after this, the paper's editor, who was a member of the Trilateral Commission, fired him. And there's tons of stories like this of reporters getting sacked. But from time to time, there's an investigative journalist that managed to get some notes or recordings from hotel staff or some other conscientious objector. So there's this guy, Lithuanian-born reporter Daniel Estulin. He got hold of a copy of an audio recording of a speech Henry Kissinger gave at the 1992 Bilderberg Conference in Evian, France. Let me read what he said. He said, "Today, Americans would be outraged if United Nations troops entered Los Angeles to restore order. Tomorrow, they will be grateful. This is especially true if they were told there was an outside threat from beyond, whether real or promulgated, that threatened our very existence. It is then that all people of the world will plead with world leaders to deliver them from this evil. One thing every man fears is the unknown. When presented with this scenario, individual rights will be willingly relinquished for the guarantee of their well-being granted to them by their world government."
Well, that's Jake Morphonius, the Blackstone Intelligence. Lots of interesting stuff about Joseph Rettinger, but then he goes off on one, I think, with Daniel Estulin. And my opinion of Daniel Estulin and his book on the Bilderberg is that it's largely a distraction. There's some good stuff in there, but he's not really talking about, you know, some of the key origins, particularly with the Allied deals at the end of the Second World War with the Nazis. I don't necessarily even believe that quote there. I mean, no. He's saying he's got a recording.
That.
You know, this to me doesn't sound like the sort of thing that would be said by David Rockefeller at one of these meetings, because whoever said it. It's not exactly that. Is not the sort of, if you read the actual transcripts of the conferences, what they're doing is they're trying to sort of mollycoddle and cajole people. They're not making great speeches about world government. There's going to be a world government. Are you on board? This sort of thing. It's much more subtle than that, and obviously these people are not hitting you directly and being upfront with you if you're a political leader that might be on board or not. And I always remember having a lovely conversation with the Greek finance minister at the Bilderberg conference in 2003 at Versailles, who'd come out of the conference because of the he found the atmosphere very stuffy and everything very expensive, and he just had a bit of a break, and rather than spend it with all these high-flying bigwigs, he wanted to come out and talk to members of the public and the press. And he came and sat down and had a coffee and a cigarette with us. And his attitude was that these people were just trying to bamboozle everybody, and he was very pleased to have a little bit of oxygen and air from the outside world. Martin.
Yeah, I mean, I think the problem is that you've got people who are professional, or they see themselves as dedicated conspiracy theorists, and they then spin. I mean, there are definitely conspiracies. The question is, what are they? And of course, you know, you can hear the American accent with our contributor there. And of course, the big fear for the American right wing is the idea that America could be told what to do by anybody else. Hence the fear that they could have UN troops in Los Angeles. Just think of it. UN troops in Los Angeles. I mean, we have UN troops in Yugoslavia, UN troops in Haiti, but in Los Angeles, unthinkable. And of course, it's unthinkable for right-wingers in America, and that's what they get upset about.
And I was rather pleased.
It's actually, that, I mean, if there were UN troops in Los Angeles, it wouldn't really bother me one way or the other.
I was rather pleased that the guy there was using the Gordon Tether from the Financial Times quotes, which I put up on the for the first time online. On the Bilderberg.org website, and there's lots of stuff there. People are interested in looking into the origins of it. And I suppose the other thing that you could do is have a look at my book, The Siege of Heaven, which has got a whole piece in there. It's got the, for example, it's got Mike Peters' excellent paper, which came out in the mid-1990s, Bilderberg and the Project for European Unification, which really goes through with a whole load of fantastic footnotes. He was a sociology professor up in Leeds, looking into the whole thing from top to bottom. What is this group? What's it really all about? And he also uses such gorgeous language to describe things. Like he finishes up, Martin, with a chapter, or one of the sections of it is, it's immensely readable for an academic paper. It's one of the most readable academic papers I've ever come across. Is he says that it's the silence of it was the time that the silence of the lambs was in the cinemas, and he called it entitled this whole thing the silence of the academics. And of course, academia has steered well clear of this, as people know that it's highly politically charged, and they may lose their jobs. In fact, someone like, was it Kees van der Peel had written about this, and he's also been an academic who's been targeted over other issues. I think it's to do with being accused of anti-Semitism or something, as I have, as many people have, who've criticised the Bilderberg group, there's not a whiff of anti-Semitism about what we're saying. In fact, we're looking at the facts. And what's happened is, over the years, there was a lot of anti-Semitism saying that the Bilderberg was a Jewish conspiracy, but it's people like me that have been pointing out things like, well, David Rockefeller's not, you know, he's one of the key figures in it, he's not Jewish, he's an American Baptist, Martin.
That's right. I mean, the elite doesn't, you know, the Rothschilds are Jewish, and they are definitely part of the elite. But the J.P. Morgan and Jamie Dimon and lots of these other people are not. And it's, you know, the idea that there is a Jewish conspiracy behind what's going on is anti-Semitic. But the idea that there is a conspiracy is just bald factuality, isn't it? Money talks.
Yeah, it certainly does. Anyway, so let's have a look now at this the other article, which is by Will Bennion, which is he's on his website, which is conspiracyarchive.com. Absolutely hot off the press on this week. He's saying seal of approval, Bilderberg and the origins of the Trilateral Commission. Now, I don't know what you know about the Trilateral Commission, Martin, but I know that this is a sort of it's a kind of a little bit like a one step down from the Bilderberg, in that it includes wider spread of countries. It's a sort of a Bilderberg for third raters, for people countries.
And it's called the Trilateral Commission because it brings in the Japanese, especially, so it's not just a European American focused organization. It's focused also on Southeast Asia, because the Japanese were. The Japanese traditionally don't go to Bilderberg. But of course, all elites are constantly having these meetings. I've just been reading a biography of Machiavelli from the 15th century. And of course, they were networking even then. It's what elites do.
So you're absolutely right. It was all about Japan, because there were attempts by David Rockefeller to bring the Japanese in to the Bilderberg meetings. And, of course, the Japanese were not in NATO. So there was a sort of slight little clash there. And as an example of the former claims, one needs to look no further than the final book of the late Jim Mars. And the book is called The Secret Society That Hijacked the World in 2017. Mars claimed the decision to create the Trilateral Commission was largely because of the need to create an alternative organisation to the Council on Foreign Relations, because that has been seen as an instrument of control by the liberal Eastern establishment. To remedy this, in 1973, plutocrat David Rockefeller, national security academic Zbigniew Brzezinski, founded the Trilateral Commission. According to Mars, plans for a commission of trilateral nations were first presented by Brzezinski during a meeting of the Bilderberg Group in April 1972, the small town of Knokke in Belgium, I probably pronounced that wrong. With the blessing of the Bilderbergers and the CFR, the Trilateral Commission began organising on July the 23rd to 24th, 1972. That's just about 6 weeks after the Bilderberg meeting in 1972 finished. Off they went with the Trilateral Commission. But although he doesn't cite many references to that, what Will's done is he's actually tracked down leaks from that conference, proving what he said is absolutely correct, that that's where the Trilateral Commission came from, that specific Bilderberg conference.
Yeah, and in other words, what we've got are overlapping networks of elite power, and they've got different mechanisms for coordinating their activities. They don't always agree. They, you know, they may have different strategies, for example, for dealing with enemy nations like China or Russia. So the idea that they don't get together and plot and plan is absurd. Of course they do. The question is, what are they doing when they're doing it? And of course, there's an awful lot of speculation, and sometimes people are basically projecting onto reality what they think is going on, but the evidence for it is not there. And they don't understand the patterns of what they're looking at.
I think we'll finish this week. Obviously, we're going to have our conspiracy classics finally. But Alistair Campbell, Martin, he's the guy who was behind the spinning of the death of Dr. David Kelly. Certainly knew a lot about that. And that back in 2003, amazingly, he's just been reincorporated into the television world, and he's become a Good Morning Britain host. I mean, I just find the man absolutely vile, complete fake. You know, he was the spin doctor behind Tony Blair. And what was that series you used to like, where he was actually portrayed in that series?
The Thick of It.
Oh, The Thick of It, that's right. Anyway, so he accidentally announces the death of the Queen this week, 2 days ago, on that programme. So not exactly a professional journalist. What do you make of Alistair Campbell becoming a sort of great TV presenter guru character?
You know, he's basically trying to make a living, a bit like David Cameron being shilling for Greensill.
He's not a credible person. You know, he's just somebody who's been involved in the war crimes of the Iraq war. He was the, you know, number one spin guy all the way through that hideous Tony Blair area. The dreadful, I mean, some obviously good things happened as well, like the Northern Ireland peace. But I just don't have any trust in the guy whatsoever. I can't imagine most of the audiences have got any trust in him. So Piers Morgan has gone, and this guy has now turned up like a bad penny to take over from him.
Well, he's going to try and make a living, isn't he?
The networks, I'm not blaming him. What I'm saying is, why do the networks think that somebody so untrustworthy is worthy of being put onto Good Morning Britain?
Because he was quite successful as a spin doctor, and that involves, of course, twisting the truth.
A liar.
Yes. And in actual fact, that's basically what a lot of people do for a living. And he was relatively successful at it. I mean, he was masterminded 3 New Labour victories, and he's regarded as somebody who knows a bit about politics. And
you think Alistair Campbell masterminded those, or the City of London masterminded
those? Well, the
them.
City of London had to be on side, otherwise it wouldn't have been allowed, would it?
I think he's a front man for the City. I don't think he's the
mastermind.
Well, I
mean, they all are, Tony.
Yeah.
They all are. I mean, name me one that isn't.
Who?
Jeremy Corbyn, maybe?
Well, Jeremy Corbyn is definitely not a front man.
Well, that's the point, isn't it? There are established people who are allowed, you know, Piers Morgan and all the rest of it. These people are allowed to have their opinions because they're bought and paid for. And anybody who's outside the consensus, they just get silence.
So what do we do about this then? I mean, this is a private media, but this is ITV, which is private. But
well, that's right. If they want to employ him and he takes the job, the only thing that would make them sack him is if their ratings go down the drain, which may well happen if he comes out with stuff about how the Queen's dead when she isn't, and he can't make it interesting to the audience and all the rest of it, then they will say, sorry, your contract's not going to be renewed.
Okay, and also, have you got the NHS app on your phone?
Nope.
Are you pinging it every time you go past somewhere?
Nope.
Well, there is. I just wonder if there's going to be any take-up for this, because they're saying that next week it's going to become your vaccine passport, that having a vaccine will allow you to travel. We shall see how this goes, because obviously if the world situation deteriorates, you know, the trade wars and the possible shooting wars, then that's also going to be a barrier to travel, not just not having had a vaccine, is it?
Absolutely. I mean, it's quite likely that 2021-2022 is going to be a major inflection point since World War II. And if people think that because we've got a relatively successful vaccination program in Britain, that the COVID crisis, that the financial crisis, that the potential nuclear warfare crisis, I mean, this is what we were discussing.
These are just used as threats, surely. This is saber rattling.
No,
the idea is to chase people up down a certain line.
No, in actual fact, the system, looking at it, if you were looking at it objectively from outside, the system is in terminal crisis. And all these things are going to start interacting on each other. We're not just going to have a health crisis over here, a financial crisis over there, and a warfare crisis over there. They're all going to be interacting with each other. Strap on your tin helmets time.
Well, let's hope that we don't need to have these vaccine passports, because that really would be probably the worst kind of infringement on people's civil liberties possible, really. The idea that you've got to have...
I think it's inevitable, Tony.
You think it's inevitable? Why?
Because if you want to travel...
It's inevitable that it's not going to happen.
Well, no, I don't get
wrong.
Because
you're going to get certain countries who will say, oh, well, we don't need a vaccine passport, and those countries are going to get all the tourists.
No, because in actual fact, there's going to be what's going to happen is that unless you've got a vaccine passport, you won't be able to go to certain places, and it won't necessarily be compulsory. You can say, I'm not having it, and say, right, well, you can't go to France, or this is
a major thing that people have been campaigning around, and it does look as if there's a fairly strong contingent in Westminster that's going to stop it.
Tories. It won't necessarily be compulsory to have one. But if you haven't got you won't be allowed to go to... Other countries will make their own rules about this, Tony. It won't be decided by the British
Parliament.
Maybe
countries will be judged on whether they demand these kind of passports or not. Yes, we shall see. Anyway, so finally tonight, we're going to be hearing from... It's Conspiracy Classic 6, which isn't a bit unfair, really, because there are some better interviews with John Morgan, who did the books about the Princess Diana assassination, and really proved it beyond any shadow of a doubt by transcripts from the inquest, which of course was found unlawful killing, which many people forget about. It wasn't an accident, but officially, and also the two major police investigations, both the Scotland Yard one and the French police investigations, where he gets all his data from. So we'll finish tonight with a short clip, 5-minute clip from an interview I did before he died with John Morgan, the author of so many books about the Princess Diana assassination. Probably the most easy to read one is the Paris-London connection. But let's have a listen now as our final item tonight to John Morgan talking about Princess Diana.
If the doctors were doing the right thing, they would have then realised straight away, well, we can't deal with this in the ambulance. You can't fix an internal problem like a torn vessel in the ambulance. So then you've got to get the person to the hospital. And you can tell from the transcripts of the messages going back and forth, or the conversations with the base, with the ambulance base. The base is saying, well, haven't you left the town yet? When are you leaving? And they were saying, well, in a few minutes. But then it took another, 20, 25 minutes or whatever. But anyway, all up was 1 hour, 43 minutes. And so, but on top of that, in the transcript, it also says nothing for the thorax. So the doctor in the ambulance is telling the base, nothing for the thorax. Now, they know there's a thoracic trauma. Why are they saying nothing for the thorax? They said it twice to the base. And you have an expectation that doctors in an ambulance are going to be telling the base what the problems are, not what problems aren't there. And so the reason they would do that is if they wanted to get to the hospital and make sure that the hospital hadn't called in their cardiothoracic specialist who was in the middle of the night who was at home asleep. And that's exactly what happened. They got to the hospital and there was no cardiothoracic specialist on hand. And so there's just the other thing they did, that they were pouring in catecholamines, which is something that is used to increase the blood pressure. Now, her blood pressure was on the low side, and the specialist at the inquest said, well, at that blood pressure of 70, you would just put the foot on the accelerator and get the person to the hospital. But that's not what these people did. They decided to pour in these catecholamines, knowing full well, and a doctor would know full well, that any catecholamines poured in like that over a long period is going to put any much more pressure on any tear or any problem, internal problem. And, you know, like I said before, she had a torn pulmonary vein, so doing that is just exacerbating the internal problem.
Just going back to the question I asked a bit earlier, which is your sources for your books. What were the main sources, the investigations and the leaks that you've got?
Yeah, sure. The sources are mainly the official evidence, like the inquest itself, which ran for 6 months and 7,000 pages of transcripts, and then also the Paget report, which I think was 832 pages. And then there was also...
That was a British police report, was it?
Yes, that's right, yes. And then also there was the... a whistleblower who leaked several hundred documents to me that were from the British police investigation, Paget, and that they came to me in 2010 after I'd published a couple of volumes of the Diana Inquest series. Those documents were pretty critical.
Have you been able to verify those?
Oh, yeah, they're absolutely... there are things like the post-mortem reports for Princess Diana and Dodi Fayed, which the jury were prevented from seeing. So, you know, the jury were expected to establish the cause of death. That's what their job is, to establish the cause of death.
I mean, I think you've made a very good case, really, for it being an assassination. You mentioned MI6. Who were MI6 people in Paris that weekend, then?
Okay, well, the one who was head of the operation, that was Sherard Cooper-Coles, or Cooper-Coles, I think, as it's pronounced. And he was brought into Paris just within 2 weeks of when the crash occurred.
And what evidence have you got that he was actually involved, though? I mean, he could have been just having a holiday there or something.
No, well, I mean, it's very complex to establish which people were involved, but there's evidence there that certainly just that he was brought in at a very late stage and that he was the head of the political department there. So, no, he wasn't on a holiday.
Okay, so that's John Morgan there speaking to me a few years ago. And he's the author of Princess Diana, The Paris-London Connection, and various other books. There's one, I think, which is the last that he published, which is an absolute classic. So, anyway, time to sign off now. Thanks to our guest, Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers, and to sound engineer Dave Bazenko. To be included on my weekly email circulation list, do email me at tony@cultureshop.org.uk. You'll find that address on the contact tab at thisweek.org.uk. And also, the book that's been flying off the shelves, well, quite fast, which is a summation of lots of the research I've been doing over the last 25 years on the Bilderbergers and the end game of the Second World War, the deals done between the Nazis and the Allies. I think quite fascinating stuff. Plus, a little look in there too at the big background context of this, which is Albert Pike and his plan for three world wars and revolutions, which was designed to create a world government. That was his plan back in the 1870s, and he was a Confederate general. In fact, when we had the Edward Colston statues, the former merchant venturer, which was thrown into the lake here, or into what we call the floating harbour here in Bristol, by a bunch of activists last year, the Black Lives Matter demonstration. He was the former slave trader that we've been campaigning for many years, actually, to get that statue removed and put in a museum or something. And the authorities, the various authorities, just blocked it. You know, I would say the merchant venturers, the people that own the city, the local Illuminati, stopping it effectively. So that was paralleled in a bizarre way with Albert Pike's statue being attacked over in Charlottesville in the United States. So there's still this sort of umbilical cord, I suppose, between Britain and America and the New World and, of course, the New World Order, that the Brits and the merchant venturers here, and the genocide that they created over there. So I put quite a bit about that, what we know about this Albert Pike letter, which is now designed to, or said to have been disappeared from the British Library, but a lot of people wrote about it before it disappeared. So it's very difficult to prove, as some people have tried to do, that it never existed at all. In fact, that's an impossible thing to prove, and yet people are still trying to do it, which I find fascinating. Anyway, he was the Grand Master of Scottish Rite Freemasonry over there. So I'm getting off on one, but that is called The Traitors of Arnhem is the book, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, and that is available for £15 as a real paperback copy. So you can get hold of that through my website at bilderberg.org, www.bilderberg.org, and it's there on, I think it's on eBay, that you can get it too. So, in fact, you can even find it now on bookfinder.com, which is a great place to find books, new and secondhand, www.bookfinder.com. And I'm not getting any money from them, but they're a fantastic little site which has done a great, I've got many books over there from them over the years. So anyway, that's called The Traitors of Arnhem. It's now available in paperback. It was published during the Halloween lockdown as an ebook, but now you can actually, sort of flick through it and even scribble notes in the margins, which I always do with books I read, even though as a youngster I was told not to do that. But I'm afraid I do it. And I usually make my own indexes up as well when I read a book, because, you know, I don't always agree with the priorities that people are writing an index have. Anyway, you can download our MP3s and listen in the car or anywhere you like. You'll find Not the BCFM Politics Shows podcast, story links, comment page, and our contact details at thisweekoneword.org.uk. I'm shadow banned on Twitter at Tony Gosling, and I'm asking people to write to Ofcom if you'd like to about the political removal of our show by the Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees's longtime chum, BCFM station manager Patrick Hart. Ofcom's address and those of the head honchos are on the contact tab at our show page, thisweek.org.uk. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the PRSC stream, and over Sunday lunch at cambly'sradioquk.com. Do please make recordings of the stream if you like to from here, you can censorship, because censorship and self-censorship of life-saving information is sadly the norm in the UK today. The collusion is between the treacherous media managers and, of course, Big Pharma. So if you can restream us live or broadcast over the weekend, do please credit this show at thisweek.org.uk. Let me know and we'll credit you here. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. You can join us at 2, or either in Castle Park, if you want to join the Palestine demo here in Bristol, or at 2 in College Green for the anti-lockdowners, the pro-healthers, the light newspaper fans. Do please join us for the Politics Show live stream at 5 o'clock next Friday. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
See you later. never comes to the Middle East, where the worries never seem to cease. On earth, goodwill to all men. Words often said, but really ever meant. World War III, the earth shatters in pieces. Is that what the meaning of peace?